everyone.
Good afternoon.
We start a public hearing today in the Tompkins County Legislature. In the public hearing at 5:30 concerning the Tompkins Brooklyn Community College operating budget 2020-2021. Is there anyone here to speak to the public hearing, the topic of the public hearing? We've been getting notice from anyone, and I don't see anyone.
I saw Bill Talbot from college. I don't see him now.
I'm here. All right. I can answer any questions if anybody had any.
No questions and no one to speak to TC3's budget at the public hearing. Mike Lane?
I just wanted to point out that the legislature had along with Cornell legislature, had a thorough briefing on this. So probably you're not hearing questions, at least from the legislators on this tonight. Bill did that for us.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Bill. Anyone else? All right. We'll close the public hearing and open the meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature, September 1st, 2020. All right. George, are you waving?
Yes, yes. I'm hearing
the meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature, September 1st, 2020.
I'm hearing the audio twice, like it's delayed.
George, are you waving?
Yeah.
It's you, George. It's you.
I'm hearing the audio twice,
George, are you waving? I've always wanted to do that to folks, George. Have my voice echo from several different places. Just sort of, you know, throwing my vocal powers around.
I always wanted to do that.
George, I think you need to turn something off on your end.
Oh, I wonder what that might be.
Not sure.
All right. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call of members.
Dan Corman.
Present.
Mike Lane?
Here.
Dave McKenna?
Here.
Len Morey?
Here.
Martha Robertson?
Here.
Mike Sigler?
Here.
Shauna Black has asked to be excused. Amanda Champion?
Here.
Deborah Dawson?
Here.
Penny Dranison?
Present.
Rich John?
Here.
Anna Kellis?
Here.
Dan Klein?
Here.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Present.
13 members present.
Thank you. We have a quorum. Just so anyone watching knows, you see the folks who are on the Zoom screen, but in the legislature chambers, joining me are Mike Lane and legislator Dan Klein. Presentations, proclamations, petitions, and communications. You would have received many notices or communications. And today, we offer a special proclamation. Usually, the chair of the legislature reads the proclamations that are being offered. But today, I wanted to share that opportunity with two people who represent much of what the individual we're talking about stood for. So I'm going to call on Dr. Kenneth Clark and Ann Corman, Chair of the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, to read the proclamation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to read the title, and then Dr. Clark will read the first half, and then I'll continue from there. This proclamation is paying tribute to the life and legacy of Kirby Edmonds, a tireless worker for civil and human rights, conflict resolution, diversity, inclusion, equity, and justice in Ithaca, Tompkins County, and beyond.
Whereas for decades, Kirby Edmonds was a managing partner of Training for Change, TFC, a human relations training and consulting firm. In this role, Kirby was a management consultant, facilitator, trainer, and whereas Kirby worked individually, but mostly with his TFC manager partner, Laura Branca, to support individuals and groups in managing conflict, team building, supervisory issues, building and valuing diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace, managing stress and work environments and network organizations. And whereas Kirby also served our community as program coordinator and senior partner of the Dorothy Cotton Institute, providing human rights education workshops for staff in public schools and with community youth workers. And whereas Kirby was a volunteer mediator for the Conflict Dispute Resolution Center, CDRC, for over 30 years, as well as past mediation skills trainer and board member of CDRC. And whereas in fulfilling his vocation, Kirby worked with public, private, and voluntary sectors, public and higher education, local government, grassroots community organizations, not-for-profit organizations and unions. He consulted with public-private partnerships and networks nationwide, helping work groups and large organizations develop diversity initiatives, facilitating countless community trainings and dialogues on racism, diversity, equity, and inclusion, among which is a Cornell University TED Talk, How We Can Eliminate Structural Poverty, and
whereas Kirby authored numerous training manuals addressing conflict management, cultural competency, racial healing, communication skills, and group facilitation. The organizations and networks for which he wrote such manuals include UNICEF, the National Treasury Employers Union, Corning Incorporated, the Pennsylvania Department of Health, National Skills Standard Board, the National Rural Development Partnership, the Supreme Court of Ohio, AFL-CIO, Union Executives in the Manufacturing Sector, the Migrant Workers Alliance in New York State, and Multicultural Leadership Projects for Youth. And whereas in 2019, Kirby assumed the role as Vice Chairperson of the Tompkins County Human Rights Commission, an advisory board of the Tompkins County Legislature. And he played a central role in reestablishing the commission as an important advocate for social justice. And whereas our community has a strong history of coming together to address community needs, but Kirby made that coming together stronger as he coordinated and championed the Cradle to Career Collective Impact Initiative and Building Bridges, pulling minds and resources together from across all sectors to solve problems collaboratively. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Tompkins County Legislature acknowledges that Tompkins County has lost a faithful, persistent, and truly gracious advocate for freedom, justice, equality, and reconciliation in Kirby Edmonds. Resolved that Kirby made a remarkable impact on the lives of those who knew him and even those who did not know him but benefited from his wisdom. And the Tompkins County Legislature calls upon all our citizens to honor the life of Kirby by doing our part for social justice and racial equity. His legacy implores us as his co-laborers to continue to carry on the struggle for interpersonal and social transformation.
Thank you very much, Dr. Penn. Thank you, Annie, for that very fitting proclamation honoring the life and legacy of Kirby Edmonds. And at this point, I am going to ask you all to indulge us in a moment of silence in the memory of Kirby. Thank you. Rest in power, Kirby. Rest in power. Your work certainly will not be forgotten, and we know that it will carry on in this community. Thank you all again for this proclamation. I will go to privilege of the floor for the public. I don't know that there was anyone. Is there any need for executive session today? No, not that I'm aware of. And now we'll move to municipal officials. Privilege of the floor for municipal officials. I did see George and Town of Ithaca Supervisor Rob Howe. Either one of you still there?
Yep. You want to go first, Rob?
No, go ahead, George.
Okay, hello, everyone.
Hi, George.
I got my double voice straightened out all by myself. I would like, on behalf of City Council and everyone, all the citizens of City of Ithaca, to echo your proclamation about Kirby. He lived down the street from me. He's a wonderful man, such an important player in this community, and we grieve his loss. I would also like to, on behalf of everyone in the city, send my best wishes to Shauna Black, who's dealing with some health issues. We think the world of you, Shauna, and I hope you get better soon, and you'll be at the next meeting next month when I'm back in front of you all. I've got several things from council today. First, from TCOG, the Tompkins County Council of Government, an important pamphlet has finally been produced. It's about water resources in Cuga Lake and boat cleaning, which is so crucial to stopping the spread of the harmful algaes and Varicella. And it's all ready to go. It needs to be published, and we may ask us pay for making copies of this, so just so you know. In council, City Council, over 60 of the over 80 people that were furloughed, employees that were furloughed, are back at work, and soon we hope to have everyone back at work, which is good news.
Yeah.
This month, or tomorrow, at our meeting, we'll be talking about 5G, which is the new technology that Verizon... we're going to vote on whether we want to become lead agency for environmental review guidelines to kick the process off. There are guidelines that were brought to us in city administration that we want to beef up and make more stringent. So that's going to happen tomorrow. We hope to work with the Town of Ithaca in developing these guidelines, and we may hire a consultant who has a lot of experience dealing with 5G and with Verizon, and has had good results in other communities in New York State. The second thing we'll be dealing with is, you probably have heard of this, the New York State Department of Transportation would like to do some major changes on traffic patterns in the West End. This has been initiated because they're concerned about traffic impacts of West End development, particularly Carpenter Business Park and I can never remember the name of the other one. It's the Johnson Boatyard. They're worried about those just jamming up traffic on Route 13. Asking us to agree to make one block of Buffalo Street between Fulton Street and Meadow Street one way east, and to make that same block of Court Street either one way west or a three-lane street, which would eliminate all the parking on the street and have two lanes going west and one east. This came at us all of a sudden. Public comments, we're going to have meetings, and also if anybody wants to chime in now, the planning department is taking email comment on this issue. That's all I have except for two questions for you all. One is, I was hoping that I could get some information about room tax income and from hotels, if that's improved in the last month or two. If I could get that information, I'd appreciate it. And the other thing is kind of a blast from the past. When Pam McAsee was on the county board or county legislature, she did quite a bit of work trying to cut down on the number of big trash trucks that were running through Tompkins County and the city of Ithaca on their way to Seneca Meadows and back from Seneca Meadows to downstate. And we're seeing a big increase in these trucks now this summer. And I can't remember if you all passed a resolution about this or if you had any contact with Seneca County or Waterloo or Seneca Falls, and if you had contacts with the state about this, because these trucks are rattling everybody's dentures on East State Street, and actually people's plaster coming off the walls because they're shaking so much. So if you know anything about that or can direct me as to where I can get some relief for this, I'd appreciate it. That's all I have.
Thank you, George. So, George, very quickly, I'll take the latter of your two questions. I did get your email, and Kathy Colbert, clerk of the legislature, who knows everything, by the way, and I have been doing some research, and no, we did not pass a resolution to deal with that issue. But there was some work done on truck traffic in general when construction was happening. We do have some of that information that I can pass on to you, if that might be helpful.
Yep.
And room tax, you're asking if that got any better. Was that your question?
Yes.
So I'll be looking to Jason and or Rick.
No, it hasn't gotten any better, but I guess you know, we can talk about some. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but right now, so I think a few months ago, there were some adjustments done to the tourism program revenue. Nick Hellman and myself and Katie just reviewed expectations for most of the third quarter and fourth quarter, and right now the assumptions that were made are not being realized in terms of actual receipts. So I think there'll be some revisions that'll be brought to HED in the next month or so, but it does not appear to be turning around right now. It's hard to give a context. I'll have to, you know, show you what the expectation was in terms of the budget versus what was estimated, but it's still sluggish, to say the best.
Is there a way you can send me that information?
Yes, we can put something together, George, and we'll get it out to you.
Thank you very much. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, George. Any other questions for George? Amanda?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, George, for stopping by here and informing us of everything. My question is about the West End traffic, the change. And you said they're taking comment, but I guess my question is, like, is this something that's going to happen no matter what? Or, like, so it doesn't really matter how many people give comment? Or are they really taking public comment?
They're really taking public comment, and it's not a done deal.
Okay.
Although I will say that New York State holds a lot of the cards because both these are, you know, New York State holds a lot of the cards, but this is not a done deal by any means.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Thanks, George. Thanks, Amanda. Rich John? Nice and profound, Rich. Nice.
Yeah. No, I was having trouble with my mute. Sorry about that. George, thanks for coming in. I watched the video of the Common Council meeting about the golf course, and I thought you guys had a really good discussion. I'm wondering if there's any next steps coming out of that. Does it look like there's a through path, or is that just totally uncertain at this point? Thanks.
I think I agree. It was a good discussion, and I think there definitely is a through path. One option is that some private entity would run the golf course or run the clubhouse and try to increase the revenue. And, of course, the developers... what's the name of that development called at Johnson Boatyard?
City Harbor.
They're talking about actually building a new clubhouse that would also be a boater's like store and clubhouse. So having them run that part of it is a possibility, but I think there's several ideas about how revenues could be increased. But, of course, with simply the weather and this year with the coronavirus, because the golf course, unfortunately, is closed, still has to be maintained. But there's no revenue this year. But I don't think the golf course is in jeopardy. That's my personal opinion.
Thank you, George.
All right. Thank you. Martha Robertson?
Thanks, Lawson. Thanks, George. Your question about the room tax, was that specifically about the hotels that haven't been paying or about the room tax collections in general?
Both.
Okay, because I think Rick Snyder can fill you in a little bit on there were eight or so hotels that had not been paying. Is there, before I go to, like, ask Rick to answer that, is there a place on the city website where we can find out what the actual proposal is? I found an article from the Ithaca Times, but is there somewhere on the city website?
I don't know what proposal you mean.
On the traffic changes from the DOT.
Oh, I don't know the answer to that, but I'll find out.
Okay, thanks a lot.
That's a good idea. Yeah, there should be.
Okay, thanks.
Martha, you probably didn't hear this, but Jason already indicated that he will be in touch with George with the information he's seeking. about room tax.
Right. It was also about specifically about the hotels.
Yeah, I think they can. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Henry.
Yes. Hi, George.
Hi, Henry.
I know that. The bill to the hotel occupancy tax for the city was on the governor's desk. I want to know whether there's any update to that. And also, what's any update about the conference center?
Did I freeze?
Yes, sir.
I didn't hear your first question very well, Henry. Could you repeat it, please?
Oh, yeah, about the hotel occupancy tax that the city wanted. And it was at the governor's desk, and I was wondering whether you have any update on that.
I don't have any update on that. And I did not know he was looking at it yet. So I don't know.
And then the second question is, any update on the conference center?
It's moving ahead, but everybody's very concerned about the room tax. So there's been no change, but I'd say council's getting nervous. At least this council member is.
Thank you, George.
Yep.
Ann Foreman.
Thank you. George, I don't know if anybody mentioned we're considering revoking the 3%, the reduction in sales tax to small Airbnbs. So that's on our agenda tonight. What I wanted to say to you regarding the traffic change was that I've had a number of people state that they are concerned as far as emergency vehicles getting up this way, up the hill in the West End, because of Buffalo Street being made a one-way. It's my understanding that it would be a one-way going towards Ithaca, correct? That block?
That's correct.
Right. So then that could possibly make any emergency vehicles or traffic at the end of the day more congested. So that's some of the feedback that I've gotten.
Also, I've gotten the same feedback from not only my constituents on West Hill, but also people who live in the Washington Park neighborhood in the Second Ward are concerned about more traffic on Court Street. Bicyclists use Court Street to go west to the West End. And so there's a lot of concerns, and we haven't even begun with the West End development on Cherry Street and across the inlet from Tagana. From Inlet Island, this is a big problem, and I think the best solution, well, not solution, but the best next step is a comp.
Thank you, George. Thank you for joining us today, George. Thank you for your questions, legislators.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. I didn't get a question from Anna Kellis. I'm hurt.
I was trying to, like, save you.
Oh,
that,
George, so see what you started? All right.
I'm not asking for one. I'm just telling you.
We have Town of Ithaca Supervisor Rob Howe, who's waiting to join us next. Rob?
Good evening. I appreciate the proclamation for Kirby Edmonds. I was sitting here thinking about the multiple ways that I was able to interact with Kirby over the years, and, of course, was delighted to work closely with him as the Town for History and Culture came together, and the Dorothy Cotton Institute was an important part of that. So Yes, he will be sorely missed. The town of Ithaca would like to thank the county for their leadership during these extraordinary times. We've really benefited from the regular calls that Jason has headed up with Frank often there and others as well. So thank you very much for your leadership on the whole COVID-19, and I know the calls will continue for the foreseeable future. So thank you. Just a few updates. We have been working on our budget for 2021, and we have set aside $50,000 for the Community Housing Fund, so we'll be putting that in a reserve account. So hopefully there will be a wonderful project that comes up sometime in the town of Ithaca. Martha, I saw the smiles are good. So thank you for your help on giving us information about that. I chair the TCOG Energy Committee, and we're looking at community choice aggregation. Deborah has been participating in those meetings. We're right now going about educating ourselves, trying to educate municipal officials about community choice aggregation. What does it mean? What are the options? Certainly, this is not a new topic. There had been a subcommittee of TCOG a few years back for a variety of reasons. It didn't move forward. We think there's some things that have changed about that. So depending on how we move forward and depending on if enough municipalities decide that they want to join forces for CCA, we will certainly be in touch with the county to see what, if any, role the county might play in that. The town is working on a Green New Deal action plan. Of course, we're working with the city on some very specific projects, like right now finishing up work on a green energy policy for new buildings. But we, you know, while we develop our own action plan, we're certainly continuing to have conversations with the city and trying to research possibilities like community solar. What would it look like for the town of Ithaca to be more proactive in community solar initiatives? So it's fun to be at that exploration stage where you don't have to make commitments, you're just learning. So stay tuned on how we're trying to move forward on Green New Deal. Next year, the town will be celebrating its bicentennial. So we're planning a number of small initiatives. We hope that there will be an Ithaca Festival parade next year so that the town can be represented in the parade for our bicentennial. We've picked off from the We Are Ithaca project, which some of you will remember was a photography exhibit that Robin Wishna was very involved in. So we're taking photographs of people. They choose what place in the town is important to them and tell why they chose that place. So it will be both a photo exhibit and also a video display. We hope to reenact some interesting historic moments or moments from the town's history. So it's fun to go back and look at some of our own archives at the town of Ithaca. As George has already alluded to, you know, so the town is working on revising its telecommunications policy to think about small cell facilities, as that's coming up as an interesting topic. So it's been nice to collaborate with the city on trying to do some education on that topic. We do have a draft 2021 budget pulled together. If it stands, we would be complying with the property tax cap for 2021. And again, there will probably be some changes, but right now the draft would have the bill going down just slightly for town residents. That's based on a single-family residence of a value of $300,000. So we're working on our budget for 2021. So just wanted to give a few updates. It's been a while since I think the town has been before this August body. So we'll see if there's any questions.
Thank you very much, Rob. It's good to hear the updates. Questions for Rob? I have Mike Lane.
Hi, Rob. I wondered what the town of Ithaca is doing to help support our Compass County Public Library this year or in the new budget.
Right now, it's at the same level that we had in this year.
Which it was?
I think it's 15,000, but I'm not. I don't know exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Thanks, Mike. Anna Kellis?
Yeah, thank you, Rob, so much for coming and also for the leadership that the town has had with the Green New Deal. It's wonderful to watch, and I'm excited to see where it goes. I'm curious, a few things, and I had one comment, but with the budget, did you have significant deficits that you were working with to start this budget and had to make service cuts, or?
No. So the town, there's a few things that helped us. We don't rely as much on the sales tax as perhaps some other municipalities. We don't get much state aid, so that wasn't really a major issue for. I mean, certainly there were impacts to our budget. The other thing is we had fairly healthy fund balances going into this year, so we didn't lay anyone off. Well, that's not true. We laid off our two school guards. Crossing guards. So we've weathered it relatively well. We've certainly had impacts, but have tried to be very careful as we put together the 2021 budget.
Thank you for sharing that. And then you have your two hats actually coming here. One is, also your housing initiative, working with Martha. Thank you so much for that investment in affordable housing. I did want to say that as well. But your second hat that you're wearing is your TCOG chair hat, and you mentioned something earlier, and so I just had a quick question. We have been focusing on broadband here because it is obviously a really big issue in the face of COVID. That's created tremendous inequities, or at least, I mean, not created them. It has brought light to them. And so we've had conversations in our Housing and Economic Development Committee. We had an amazing meeting with the Southern Tier Network today. So a comment is that there is a municipal, a regional municipal discussion, and that I would love to bring that to you, talk to you about as potentially setting up a meeting with TCOG. So I just wanted to mention that. I'm happy to follow up with it, and I'll be highlighting that in the HED update. But I had heard that TCOG is looking at creating a subcommittee or a committee on broadband. Is that the case?
Well, I've been invited. There's certainly been initiative to pull together, especially the rural towns, to come together and look at this issue. And so I have been invited to that. The town actually has fairly good coverage. We'll probably sit in on the meeting just to find out how we can be helpful. And I do believe it's through TCOG. George may know more. I can't remember if it's a very specific subcommittee or not.
Okay. Well, I can be in touch about that.
Okay. Thank you. Martha Robertson.
Thanks, Leslie. And Rod, oh, my goodness, thank you so much. That's wonderful, wonderful news about the housing fund. We made the proposal before there was this pandemic thing. So it's really wonderful to see the town able to go forward with that. Thank you all so very much.
Well, we're pleased to be part of it.
And I see that Jason's got his video off because he's crying right now, you know, about his budget and your budget. So.
Hi, Jason.
What? I'm sorry, what, Ron?
I didn't even really want to bring it up because we know.
Yeah. Well, no, it's good for the town to be able to maintain services that your folks really depend upon, you know, government support at all levels. So that's good. Can I just ask what your tax cap level was? You happen to remember?
Looks like it was, I don't know. It was, I think, around, I don't know.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
I will say, so I know the county, I don't think the county can, I'm sorry, I'm moving on to another topic. The town has actually been reopened for quite some time. we've become a happy place because people are flocking to us for marriage licenses. I mean, it's just amazing how many people are coming to us for marriage licenses. So.
All right. Thank you, Henry.
Yes, Rod. Do you is it, if I recall correctly, are you guys working on short-term rentals regulation?
Yes, we are. that committee.
Are you with that?
That committee has been working on short-term rentals for quite some time. They take different twists and turns. So Bill Goodman, who's the deputy supervisor, has been tasked to finish that up. There's another thing that I want the deputy supervisor to work on. So it's not done yet, but I've been told we're making progress.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh, Mike Sigler, were you? Are you raising your hand, Mike Sigler?
No, no. Sorry, I had a fly. There was a fly.
You were just waving to, I got it. All right. Rob, thank you so very much. Thanks for the good news. As Martha said, in the housing funds, all great. George, thank you for joining us. You don't have to stay away, you know, Rob. You can come back every month. We'd love hearing what's going on in our municipality. So thank you for sharing. We're going to move on quickly to privilege the floor for legislators. Nice and crisp. Go ahead, Martha.
Thank you. I first want to thank Reverend Clark and Annie for that beautiful tribute to Kirby. I wrote to them this afternoon that gave me goosebumps when I read it, so really appreciate that. What a loss and what a shock. But I wanted to mention a couple of things that, well, first, everybody got an email from NYSAC. They are having a fall conference this year. It's in September, but it's going to be different. It's going to be online with, it looks like, two sessions per day over a period of 8 days. It's all free, and there's sort of specific topic webinars and discussions. So folks should take a look at that. It looks like some really interesting programs, as well as the standing committee meetings that we usually have. I want to mention that Anna and I are on the Climate Resiliency Committee. The chair has been County Executive Mark Hollenkars from Erie County. I've been vice chair. Hollenkars is stepping down, so they've appointed me to be chair of the committee. Heather Brown from Sullivan County and Bonnie Lawrence from Erie are going to be the vice chairs. And that committee meets on September 28th. I also want to mention some good news. I mean, this has been going around email with legislators and staff today, but I want the public to know that something that we started a long time ago has come to fruition today with NYSTEG submitting a proposal to the Public Service Commission to approve seven projects under the non-pipe alternative proposal. And this is something that the county and many others have been working on since 2014 or so. And whereas New York State has now got sort of a policy and a number of projects that are non-pipe alternatives to reduce the use of natural gas in the state and to support conversion to heat pumps, conversion to clean energy, it really started with Tompkins County. So a long process that we all went through. And the seven projects, there's a lot of information that's being held back so far, but we understand that one of the projects is the geothermal system at the Tompkins County Airport. So we are really thrilled and grateful to the staff who worked so hard on that proposal, Mike Hall, Andre Aguirre, Katie Borghella, and Tom Horn from CNS Engineers in particular. So we're very excited that that project was included, and we don't know what the financial benefit will be, but certainly it'll all be whatever comes our way is going to be to the good. So congratulations to the folks who worked so hard on that.
Thank you. Thanks, Martha. Rich John.
Thank you, Leslyn. I just wanted to add my voice and noting Kirby Edmonds. I had the privilege of working with him at the Tompkins Center for History and Culture on the Governance Council, and he represented the Dorothy Cotton Institute. And everything everybody said, I think, is absolutely true about the guy. But I also say he was just a real gentleman, and he had a great, very dry sense of humor. He stepped up with the Governance Council when we were at a point we needed some leadership, and he did the job. You know, he always pulled an oar and was just a great guy to work with. We will miss him. So.
Thank you very much, Rich. Anna Kellis.
Yeah, Rich, that was beautiful. Thank you. And I just want to add, you know, a word. I think if anyone has ever had a conversation with Kirby, they have felt in a moment of their life incredibly heard and respected. He had a way of listening. He kind of look askance, like, you know, to make sure not, you know, that his eyes were really focused and that he was really listening, almost like he was meditating on your words first before responding. And I very much respected that. He worked tirelessly on the food hub as well, as human rights, housing issues, anything to do with human rights issues, racial justice issues. Kirby was there. Collective impact, community engagement, and most importantly, tremendous empowerment work that he did with youth in the community. So I just want to acknowledge his beauty in the community. And I personally am absolutely not ready for him to not be here, and I know that many others are as well, feeling very similarly. So just adding my two thoughts to that. Thanks.
Thanks, Anna. Mike Lee.
I've got to continue a little bit and mention Kirby as well. My first encounter with Kirby, the first time I ever met him, was when I first came on this legislature back in 1994 and participated in the first retreat of legislators very early in that term. We had a lot of new members at that time. And Kirby was asked to facilitate that retreat that we had. And I still remember that as though it was yesterday. I remember how impressed I was with the really nice job he did for us. He helped us learn about one another. He helped us learn about meetings and behavior and manners. It's something that has stayed with me all the years on the legislature. And I, too, will miss Kirby and the opportunities from time to time that we had to interact.
Thank you, Mike. Ann Corman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to first thank Dr. Clark and you, Leslie, for writing a wonderful tribute, and I appreciate the honor of helping to read that. So as most people know, Kirby was about bringing people together. And I think that's something to remember, especially through this time that we're going through. He was about really listening to each other and really diving deep and figuring out, you know, what are the core issues. And he was also about empowering people of all ages. So I just have a feeling, you know, that if Kirby was here, he would say, okay, so I can't row the boat anymore, and I need you guys to do it. And we can all do that. And it'll I don't know how many of us it will take to take over that, but if we all do a little bit and put this as a focus for this year and for the rest of our lives, we can help take up the oars. So thank you.
Thank you. Henry?
Yes. In the vein of Kirby Edmonds, I'd like to mention the name Jacob Blake, who is now sitting in the hospital after being fired on 7 times with a bat. I just wish our prayers and that he gets better. And I wish that justice would be done by the Wisconsin Attorney General. That's all I have to say.
Here, thank you, Henry. Thank you very much. And I'm going to take this opportunity to sort of combine things, speak on privilege of floor for legislature, so it's my chair's report, to say I really wanted to take time to also add my voice to honoring Kirby. And I'm glad I had an opportunity to help craft that proclamation. It was hard to do, no doubt. Like Mike, I met Kirby many, many years ago when I first came to this community, and I consider Kirby a dear friend. We worked a lot together. We trained together. We were volunteer mediators for over 30 years together with the Dispute Resolution Center. Traveled, did a lot of work together. Kirby was just that good soul, is how I describe him. I don't think there's ever, has ever been a problem that Kirby doesn't think there could be a solution to. Often when many of us are like, oh, we don't know where to go with this, it was like, well, wait a minute, let's just, you know, think back, relax for a minute, and think some more and see where we can go from here. Clearly, it was a very shock to my system to hear of his passing. But he, you know, Kirby was a workhorse, and although he was sick and he had been in the hospital and got out, even while he was in the hospital, he was still trying to attend meetings and answer emails and so on. He did tremendous work in this community and wasn't the person who wanted to stand up front and thump his chest and look for praise. A lot of it he did even behind the scenes. His work with talking him and Laura's, the work with talking circles on race and racism that many of us participated in. Anna mentioned his work with building bridges and collective impact and just championing that in the community and bringing, you know, people together. Quiet, reserved, but always forward thinking. And I want to add my voice to honoring him today for all the work he did in this community and beyond, some of which I know people do not know. Kirby was a very good person with a vision and with heart and always in the right place, willing to facilitate from the smallest to the largest conversations when there are high levels of community conflict, and knowing that he can step in with his calm demeanor and help people to have those difficult conversations and come to resolutions, whatever those might be for them. So, Kirby, I do want to thank you, wherever you are, for the impact you made not only on my life, but the lives of so many people in this community. So many people. Whew. As this proclamation says, us as your co-laborers who were here or left here will continue to carry on this struggle. I know for one that we would not let the work that you did, your name, just go down in vain. We'll continue this work. There's probably never a time that you would see me wear a t-shirt to a legislature meeting. Today I'm wearing my t-shirt. I'm wearing my John Lewis. Get in trouble. Good trouble. Necessary trouble t-shirt. This is what Kirby reminded me of. And today we need to do that. We can't be complacent and silent and be in the background, and all of us. Voting rights are at stake. John Lewis fought and bled for it. Racial equality and equity is at stake. Something Kirby stood strong for. Traveling to the borders of Palestine and being there. Meeting with people and bringing some hope. Him and Dorothy Cotton and Laura Branca and others. And as Henry said, black men being executed in the streets, unarmed black men, continuing to happen. We all have to get in trouble, necessary trouble, to make change happen. And if there's anything we can do to uplift and keep the name and legacy of Kirby Edmonds alive, is to do our share in this struggle. So Kirby, thank you. Representative Lois, thank you. Jacob Blake, thank you. You took bullets for us. 7 bullets, point blank range, in the back. Unconscionable. And you're still alive. Tell the story. We all have to stand up. I want to take this moment to thank the members of the Human Rights Commission who took the time to come out and join us today for the reading of the proclamation. Hey, I saw you, Ruth. I also saw you. I don't know who else was there. I was trying to follow who all were on. Thank you all for continuing the work that you're doing with the Human Rights Commission and work that Kirby was involved in. Just as a quick tidbit, we all know there were some issues with the Human Rights Office and in direction. We had a public, real public, you know, display around that. And Kirby is one of the people who would come before this legislature and speak out on what they thought we were doing wrong. And when the time came, he wasn't just standing there pointing fingers and being part of the problem. He joined the commission to become part of the solution. That's Kirby. And we all can take a page out of his book and keep it going. So thanks again, Commissioner Sedin, here. Thanks, Annie and Ken, for joining me in writing this proclamation. Thank you for reading it so beautifully and honoring Kirby. Thank you, legislators, for your kind words as well. And George and Rod Howe for honoring and respecting the name of Kirby Edmonds and the work that he's done in this community. Okay, moving on. I'm going to take the consent agenda. I'm going to switch things around very quickly. And then I want to move up, and I'll come back to Jason and Rick and others, the resolution, because Bill Talbot, TC3, has been graciously waiting. Thank you, Bill. Sorry, Deborah.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just not sure how to proceed on one of the resolutions that we passed at our special meeting this afternoon of the Peak Committee. There was a resolution urging New York State to establish an active and formal role for counties.
It's not on the agenda, so we'll have to add it to the agenda.
Is it treated as a member filed? Or I'm just asking for
information. No, we'll just add it to the agenda and it'll come under Peak.
Thank you.
And we'll need 10 votes to do that. So yes, I'll get to that point and we'll make sure we do that, okay?
Thank you.
All right. So if I can just ask for a consent agenda, someone to move the consent agenda, and we'll read what's on it. And I have a move from Deborah and a second from Anna. Thank you. On the consent agenda, we have appointments. I think I have Jason Molino to the Greater Tompkins County Municipal Health Insurance Consortium Board of Directors. No term limit. And we also have under Facilities and Infrastructure, Resolution A, Airport Rental Car and Marketing and Terminal Advertising Contract Extension, Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport, ID 9488. Resolution B, authorizing agreements with CNS companies for rehabilitation of taxiway lighting, LED design, and acceptance of anticipated grant from Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport, ID 9523, and I believe this was passed by committee this afternoon.
Yes, it was.
Okay. Resolution C, authorizing award bid in anticipated receipt and acceptance of Federal Aviation Administration grant for the installation of miscellaneous NAVAIDS wind cones at the Tompkins Regional Airport. Again, committee action this afternoon. And Resolution D, authorization to change the name of Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport to Ithaca Tompkins International Airport, ID 9474, woohoo. And on the Budget and Capital Committee, Resolution E, acceptance of Census 2020 Complete Count Outreach Grant. And that was also pending committee action today. Mike Lee nodded it passed committee. ID 9532. I have already had a mover and seconder for the consent agenda in Deborah and Anna. All in favor of the consent agenda? Roll call.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dave Klein?
Yes.
Leslie Bean Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 no.
Thank you. It passes unanimously, and now we will be calling Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport. No more confusion. It'll be International Airport. Yay, yay, yay. Let's do resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda. Deborah Dawson.
Muted.
Muted.
Profound, real profound, Deborah.
It's the best I can hope for. I'd like to move this resolution urging New York State to establish an active and formal role in planning efforts related to the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, and to engage local governments throughout development of the Climate Action Council's scoping plan.
Moved by Deborah, seconded by Martha. Thank you very much. I need 10 votes to add this to the agenda, and it is Resolution J, ID 9542. Roll call.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 no.
Thank you very much. That's added, and we'll take it up at peak time.
Thank you.
All right. And now I'd like to move up Martha under your committee, Budget Committee, Resolution I, so that Bill can go home and have dinner.
Thank you very much. And Bill joined us at the Budget Capital Personnel Committee meeting at 4 o'clock this afternoon. I would like to move, and there are a couple of changes that were passed in committee. So, but I'll move it first and then describe the changes. Wait a minute, where'd it go? Adoption of the 2020-2021 operating budget, Tompkins-Cortland Community College, ID 9485.
Second.
Martha, seconded by Mike Lane.
All right, thank you.
And we have a public hearing today. There's no one commenting on it. Legislators, discussion.
If I can go ahead, there was a couple of change. There were a couple of questions, and we changed some language to try to make it a little more clear. Let me pull. And I emailed it to everybody around 4:30 or so. in the first resolve, I'm looking for it here. In the first resolve, the line that says this includes a 1.6% decrease, that should say in Tompkins County's sponsorship share this year. And I'll explain these when we're done. And the next resolved, it should say the in the 2021 Tompkins County budget, said amount pursuant to the approved plan. So we're deleting N, we're deleting to be determined. And then the next line, we're deleting when determined. So that resolve should say, resolve further that the Tompkins County Legislature includes in the 2021 Tompkins County budget said amount pursuant to the approved plan for said college in effect as of September 1st, 2020, and that the amount be raised by taxation, et cetera. So that passed out of committee.
All right. Friendly.
And it's friendly to the seconder. Thank you very much, Martha.
All right, thanks.
All right, Deb Dawson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out for the benefit of any members of the public who are watching that this budget is the amount that Tompkins County will be extending in support to TC3 as part of our formal budget process. There may be additional funds in the coming year that are needed, but those will be dealt with separately. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Henry?
Yes, Bill, thank you for the budget. Do you know whether the enrollment numbers, do you have an update of the enrollment numbers from this week, past weekend?
Yes. Yes, actually, we did well. We did have an uptick. We projected a 24% decline over last year. When we met last week and presented, we were at 30%, and as of this morning, we're at 26%. So we're within 2% of the budget.
And Bill, would you do me a favor and just for the viewing public, let them know what your position is at TC3?
I'm the interim vice president for finance and administration.
Thank you very much.
I have been working there for the last 10 months as the interim CFO.
Thank you, Bill. So just so the public know, you're not just making stuff up.
No, I'm not making it. I had the great opportunity going through this process. The other thing, I think it was Henry who asked that question. The other thing we're trying to make up the difference of that we've never done before is that we will have a later second start, but it will be a full 15 weeks, and so students will be able to use financial aid for that. It will start a little bit later and end just a little bit later. But we're hoping to make up the difference and be on target for the budget for the fall.
Thank you. Thanks, Henry. Martha?
Thanks. And Bill, just to be clear, that second round of 15-week classes, that those folks are not included in the enrollment you just described?
Not in the enrollment numbers yet, but that is included in the budget.
Okay, great. I wanted to mention, to clarify, that the 1.6% decrease in Tompkins County's share, the budget includes a flat joint county share from last year to this coming year, but Tompkins County's share drops by $128,000 and change because Cortland County's full-time equivalency enrollment has increased relative to the previous year. So our piece went from 64% of the joint county share to 63%. So that's a little savings on our side. And we did discuss whether there might be another request needed by the college later in the year, and just decided we just wanted to pass this clean solution, so the budget is set, and understanding that there are a lot of things that could change between now and the next budget. So just to reiterate,
and thank you, Martha, these are external events that occur that we can't control, not internal events.
We know.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Bill. And you were nodded in concurrence with Martha stating that the 1.6 decrease is because of enrollment.
That is correct.
Henry.
Yes. Bill and Jason, have you heard anything from Portland County regarding this budget?
Yes. I was there last Thursday night, and it passed their budget process, legislative process, last Thursday night.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Good work, indeed. Any other questions on this resolution? All right, roll call vote.
Dan Corman.
And let's not do the opposite of Cortland.
Yes.
Mike Lane.
Yes.
Dave McKenna.
Yes.
Glenn Mori.
Yes.
Martha Robertson.
Yes.
Mike Stigler.
I think I have to actually abstain from this vote. Tompkins County, the school is a client of mine, a billboard client of mine. So I don't know if I can actually vote on their budget since my regular job, I actually get some money from them. So. But if the lawyer, if the county attorney wants to weigh in on that, I'm more than happy to have him weigh in on it.
I think the county attorney is trying to weigh in.
Yeah. You can ask to abstain, and I think that's fine in this case.
We will allow you to abstain.
We will allow you to abstain to avoid any appearance of conflict on something which is obviously going to pass anyway.
All right. Thank you very much.
So Mike Stigler will be abstaining.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes. I have the same issue. I work at DC3, and I may, in fact, be teaching a class later on this year. So John has said before, it's not enough to make a difference, but I will abstain anyway.
So Henry, abstaining from the vote because you're an employee at TC3?
Yes.
That would make perfect sense, so you will abstain.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
I don't think she's there. Dan Klein?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
We have 10 ayes, 2 abstentions.
Ooh, thank you. I was getting nervous there. That passes. Thank you very much. Thank you, Martha and Budget Committee. Thank you, Bill, for hanging in with us. And thank you
for everything you do.
Vote. You're very welcome. We're happy to support the C3. Okay. Let me go back to the regular agenda. Reports from County Administrator, County Attorney, and Finance Director. Jason Molino.
Good evening, everyone. How are you? Good to see everybody. We will, all right. We have a brief, our regular COVID update. I have Frank, Amy, and Dominic also on the line. So if it's all right with you, I can put I can share the screen and put it up for you. We can go through it.
Thank you.
Yep. I can do it. We'll get it up there. All right, you can see the COVID-19 Tompkins County response. Again, this is added to a timeline that we have been doing every legislative meeting. We are putting together a similar format of kind of updates. So we have some general slides we update. We also have some new slides to talk about what that response was over the past 2 weeks. It's kind of a summary. Again, it's a great chronological order of everything, kind of reminds you of the ups and downs of everything as we've gone through it. In this case, we've had about 37 additional positive cases since August 19th, or since we last met with the legislature. Series of new executive orders, anywhere from bowling alleys, gyms. Gyms was a big one that had been pressing and waiting for a while. Fitness centers. the absentee ballot directive came out from the state in terms of voting, being able to use absentee ballots for November. Protocols on timely testing. Low-risk sports can resume mid-September. And then also the somewhat still ambiguous and still needing clarity, 100 positive cases or 5% of enrollment, whichever is lowest threshold for campuses to go remote, triggering a two-week remote session. There's some more details on that, but still some things being worked out, but in terms of on-campus, off-campus, faculty, staff, but that went into effect actually for one campus, I believe, SUNY Oneonta, earlier this week. So that has come out, and campuses are starting to learn more about the ins and outs of that executive order. Also, over the past 2 weeks, Ithaca City School District decided to go start the semester remotely with possibly coming back in October. I did speak with Jeff Mattson, the TST BOCES superintendent today, and all districts are looking to open September 14th in the county, with the exception of ICSD and Lansing, I believe, is the 21st of September. So other than ICSD, all of them are looking to open at least some partial or in-person education and schooling by next week, a week after, I'm sorry. Cornell dashboard came out. We also had a good collaborative announcement with Cornell in providing some financial support for our response. And then also today we announced, consistent with the action that the legislature took 2 weeks ago, in ensuring that community testing still is available for our community members at no cost to them, which is a great, again, thank you for your leadership, the legislature, really being, I think, one of the first legislators in the state that has made that commitment financially to ensure that testing is available. Obviously speaks a lot for your commitment, but also the ability to do it in terms of CHS, Akiga Health System's ability and capacity to provide the community testing to our residents and for prompt response and turnaround, which again also was because of your commitment with the Reonix machine and partnering with other partners like the city, some other community funders. From a communication messaging perspective, Frank Krupa, our public health director, mental health commissioner, put a letter out talking about the broader public health response, and Frank can talk a little bit about that. Food resources page was updated. We did have a public health announcement with the Simeon's restaurant. There was another public exposure with the TCAT route. During our town hall, we also talked about community needs for human services, and we're going to continue to talk about different human services in some of the upcoming community town halls as well to continue that messaging. And there was also 9 cases announced on Friday due to a gathering, and then Cornell confirmed the next day that it was a student gathering. So also a note to today, we added a new icon to the public health website, community-wide testing icon. So we'll show you that icon as well. This has to do with the cluster that we had. Frank, if you're on, do you want to take this slide and talk a little bit about some of the details of the cluster and what's happened since Friday?
Sure. Thanks, Jason. So I think everyone's aware that on Friday we did announce a cluster of within the community. Cornell subsequently identified it as a student cluster. We've been working very closely with Cornell since the first case was identified. As of today, that cluster consists of 21 positive cases. And that has spanned over the last, 5 days now. Thursday, I believe the first case was identified. The important thing to understand, two things, really. The first is there isn't a single gathering that led to this. It was a series of smaller gatherings of students. Unfortunately, they were not wearing masks or following social distancing, and so that's how this has spread amongst that group. So we have tried to be clear in our messaging that it's really important that it's not just about the size of the gathering, but also continuing to wear masks and social distancing. Certainly, seeing the number go from 9 to 21 is a big jump. But the important thing to note is that all of the new cases that have been identified since Saturday have been amongst individuals that were in mandatory quarantine as a close contact. So our work as case investigators and contact tracing is working. We are able to, through the students themselves, as well as support from Cornell, been able to identify the number of people that were close contacts and get them into quarantine. And so all of those new cases have not created additional exposures. So that's really the importance of why we do what we do to prevent the spread. Cornell has been great in collaborating with us. They are working with the students, providing housing for those students that need it to isolate and or quarantine if they need it. So they continue to be a great partner in this. And again, it's important to reiterate that these were related to multiple gatherings, smaller gatherings, where mask wearing and distancing was not adhered to. So we really encourage the community to continue to follow that guidance. This is a screenshot of Cornell's data dashboard. As you can see, they are presenting data about the testing that they are doing. It is important to know that this is data that Cornell has access to. So it might not be 100% if, say, a student went to a primary care doctor or to a testing site not outside of Tompkins County. Their results might not be known to Cornell if there was not a contact or exposure on campus. So this is Cornell's data. It's very close, and we're working very closely with them to try to be as aligned as much as we can as far as data goes. There's still work to be done to make sure that we're being clear and that the meaning of the data that we're presenting, both them and us, is clear to the community. They are working on what this will look like over time, but this is where it is now. And I will point out that their data is previous day's data, and they are not updating on the weekends as of right now. So when you get to Monday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday's data is then updated in the data. So that's why there's some difference between their data and ours as you progress through the week. Do you want me to grab this, Jason?
Go for it, Frank.
Sure. So, again, as Jason mentioned, the community-wide testing availability began today. Thank you to the legislature, to our community for supporting this. It is in partnership with Cuyahoga Health Systems, as all of our testing has been. Medically necessary testing, those folks that are symptomatic, our close contact or preoperative are covered by insurance and will continue to be. But residents of Tompkins County can access testing irregardless of previously established criteria. And it's important to note that this was developed for access. We wanted to make sure that our community had the same and a bit expanded access to testing here in Tompkins County. So for those residents that feel like they may have been exposed, or want to be tested, they have the ability to go get tested with no charge to them. Non-Tompkins County residents will need to continue to meet the requirements that are listed on Cuyahoga Health Systems' website, so we would encourage them to pre-register and make sure that they meet criteria before seeking testing there. And then, of course, we are continuing to work with businesses, as is CHS, to make sure that if there are requirements for returning to work or continued testing, surveillance-type testing that a business or organization should work to get a contract with CHS directly. This county-sponsored testing is designed for individuals, not for businesses or organizations. And Tracy Gates at Cuyahoga Health Systems is the contact for those contracting efforts.
Great. Thanks, Frank. Also, I just want to make note, thank you to Amy Hendricks. Amy, after the legislature approved this last Tuesday, worked with Tracy diligently to make sure the contract was in place and that this could go live by September 1st. So thank you, Amy, for your hard work on that. And this is the new testing icon. in case you were curious. So this is a little bit of an updated slide, a little different than the ones we've had in the past. Before we had the number of emergency leave, the amount of emergency leave that was taken, not really relevant anymore since that ended at the end of June. We have our COVID hours, amount of regular hours that have been worked, and the value of that, amount of overtime hours that have been paid, and then comp time hours is the equivalent to hours earned. So essentially, this right here is most of the leadership team that's involved. A lot of the management folks are involved that since they don't get paid overtime or accrued comp time past a certain amount, this is the amount of value of that time worth. This has to do with the family FMLA expansion, and these are employees that have taken FMLA leave under the FFCRA leave, the expansion of that FMLA leave under the CARES Act. Just to show you some employees that have taken FMLA leave under those expanded criteria and hours that they have utilized from that leave that they've been out. And then also about 400,000 related expenses since our last, or total since our last meeting, about 11,000. Here's a little bit of a summary of kind of some of the information distributed. I'm sorry, and supplies distributed. So this top part has to do everything that was donated by Cornell. So Cornell, as we are, we're early into the response, really donated a lot of supplies, as you can see, and that are distributed primarily to EMS, nursing home, and CMC staff, so that our first responders had all the equipment that they had at the time. If you remember also during this time, early March and April, there was a massive shortage of a lot of PPE. Everyone's had a mad dash to get it. So Cornell really followed through and donated a lot of supplies that they had on campus. Down here was delivered by New York State. I mean, this is what we got through the Emergency Operations Center, masks and sanitizer, and then this is what was, and also what was produced by local volunteers, and then what was distributed both to municipalities and then also to businesses. And we have plus signs here because we think they're higher than what we have in records. But one thing that I think is important to note, Dominic pointed this out earlier, is that about 14,000 local workers were able to respond through the online form, completely online form, and were able to distribute supplies to them. About 14,000 individual workers were able to help through the online form that we were created. So I think that's a great distribution of resources, and just important to note, as we've gone through this, we're pushing now 6 months or more than 6 months. We are not getting right now locally support from New York State in terms of the pipeline of supplies and materials anymore. A lot of it is going directly to a lot of it is going to school districts directly, but we're not getting it through the EOC, so we're not really doing much distribution anymore. This is a little bit of a snapshot of the town hall we had, building off of Frank's letter. When we talk about community resilience, our ability to continue to move forward, ensuring that the community understands that we're committed to responding in a variety of different areas, just not the immediate pandemic, but that we understand there are other needs in the community. We had Lisa Monroe from the Office for Aging. We had Kate Chinks Booth from New Services. Frank, obviously, from Public Health, Mental Health. Leslin, myself, we were able to facilitate a little conversation, talk about some of the challenges that we've seen in those specific areas and what we're able to do to support people who have needs. I will say all our departments have adapted really well in terms of finding different ways to provide services and reaching their customers. So we hope in not this week, but the next week, I believe, to have another town hall and to encompass some other different services that we provide so that folks are aware of some of the challenges. We're aware of some of the challenges. We're aware of how to provide those services to folks, and that no one's getting left behind as we're trying to continue to overcome the challenges for folks. And that is, I believe, the end of the presentation. Frank and Mamie, Dominic, if you have anything to add?
No, I don't think so, Jason.
All right, I guess we'd be happy to take some questions, if anybody has any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Frank, Jason, Amy, Dominic. And I am just going to go down the line of questions. There are lots of hands. Starting with Deborah Dawson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Jason. Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Frank. I know that you're probably just totally sick of COVID. But I sent you, and I sent my fellow legislators, a copy of an email that I received from one of my constituents asking if we might be able to slice and dice our data on the county health department website to show what types of sources our positive COVID patients came from, based on a model that Onondaga County uses that breaks them up into community-acquired unknown source, community-acquired known source, household contact, travel-acquired, congregate setting, senior facility, congregate setting, other, unknown. Obviously, we don't need to track every single one of those categories, but I see a lot of conversation on social media. People really would feel more comfortable if they had this information. And I know that I spoke with Leslin about this just recently, and she said, well, why do they need this? And I think that we need to remember that everybody has to make a decision for themselves, a series of decisions, every time they need to go to the drugstore or the doctor or the grocery store or get out of their house for whatever reason. And part of what they consider in making that decision is, you know, is there a real danger to me of community spread, or am I only in danger if I come into direct contact with someone who has it, or, you know, am I in significantly less danger than someone on campus or in a elder care facility? So if it would be possible to assess the data, which we get through our contact tracing and which Cayuga Med gets from patients when they come in for medically necessary testing, could we include this kind of data on our county website?
So I think there's a couple of things in there, Deborah, and I absolutely understand people's interest in more information around the data. The first thing that I would point out is that Onondaga County has significantly more cases than we do, so parsing their data out doesn't create the same confidentiality concerns that I have here. There are days where Onondaga County has more cases than we've had in a month, and so it makes it a bit more challenging. What I would say is we have tried in iterations, usually each month, and I think our plan is to do some of it again at your next meeting, is to answer some of those questions that we feel like we can parse out, because then enough time has passed that, one, we have enough cases, and enough time has passed, so it makes it less likely that you'd be able to identify an individual. What I would also tell you is that our low number of cases also makes it hard to draw any significant conclusions from one case or two cases. What we have said from the beginning is that we've been fortunate that we've had low incidence here. For looking at any particular case and saying, well, this one was community acquired, or this one was a close contact of someone in their home, what I can tell you is the majority of our cases are related to close contacts. If they aren't travel acquired, and we have put out the travel acquired data in our last update. So generally speaking, for our county, those people that are close contacts of a case are the most likely individuals to contract it, unless they traveled someplace else and were exposed. So that's generally what we have been saying, and it is still true today. We will do some parsing of data for your next meeting from an update from where we were, I guess it was a month ago now, maybe a little bit more since the last time we did that.
Well, I appreciate that, Frank, and I really don't want to be a pain in the neck about this, but, you know, this Onondaga site that was shared with this email is only slicing and dicing 22 cases. I'm not sure I understand the privacy concerns. If all you're doing is saying where somebody might have picked this up. And the other thing is, slicing and dicing it for the legislature at our next meeting doesn't really help members of the public who look at this site every day for information. I really hope that at some point here we can see our way clear to at least tell people whether, you know, today's cases were travel related or something that people picked up here in Tompkins County. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Amanda?
Yes, Jason, you said something that scared me very much, that ICSD is starting on the 21st.
Lansing is starting on the 21st. ICSD, I believe, is
the 14th.
I think they pushed it back to October.
The remote is starting on the 14th, and they're pushing back in person. Okay, that's what I thought, but I wasn't sure the way you said it.
I believe Lansing is starting in person on the 21st.
Okay, all right. Wanted to clarify. Thank you. For all those parents of ICSD students out there.
Sorry. I apologize if I misspoke.
Thank you. Henry?
Yes. Jason, I was wondering whether we have the, or Amy, do we have the law enforcement information from this weekend?
Yeah. Okay. Hi, Henry. Yes, I do. As far as this weekend, or the last week, August 23rd to the 30th, we had 34 calls total. 28 were inside the city of Ithaca, one in Cuba Heights, 3 in the town of Ithaca, 1 in Newfields, and 1 in Groton. From that, there were 6 in violation, which they received that. We continue to do the education aspect. So while a violation may not be observed when the sheriff or whomever is responding responds, they do continue to educate on that, and we take down the information and bring that back both to our own environmental health, and then if anything needs to go to any of the higher ed institutions, we send that on as well.
Okay. When are we ever going to shift from education to a violation model?
So there has been discussion about that. At this point, we're not seeing the frequency where we're seeing it at the same location multiple times. We may have had one or two where we've gone to the same location, not in the same night, that would start to have that conversation. But at this point, we continue with the education model, and people are complying. So when we arrive on the scene and have that conversation, often people are complying. There are reasons that they have been complying. In some cases, they live together, which turns into like a unit. So we're seeing a lot of compliance around this, and we'll continue to work with that. One of the challenges with all of this is when you move into a different model, you're also sending a different message. And right now, the message we're putting forward is, you know, protect each other and really have that education model.
Okay. I have a question for Frank about the cluster at Cornell. Do you know whether Cornell or you guys are going to put another press release out about the increase in this cluster from 9 to 21?
I don't think we're intending to put out a press release. Obviously, we've talked about it here tonight. I'm assuming it will be part of the notes of this meeting, and we'll be happy to answer media questions if there are any.
And I was just saying, it's already been reported in the Ithaca Voice from what was already reported from Frank, so it's been shared.
Okay. Also, I mean, I know you probably can't tell me, but is this Cornell cluster going to be limited to 21 people, or could it be bigger than that?
Well, I can never tell you for certain it's not going to get bigger. What we do know is that so far all of the new cases since Saturday have been of individuals that we had previously identified as close contacts and quarantined. So that tells us that we have this contained right now. what we'll be looking for is over the next 2 weeks, really, to see if new cases come, you know, as the incubation period evolves, to know if we have additional cases. We might, and certainly that's not a good thing. What is most important is that the cases, if they do happen, are within that group that we've already identified and quarantined, because again, they won't have been exposing other people.
Okay, final question is on the mental health side. Have you seen an uptick in the usage of mental health services? And if so, what have you done about it?
Yeah, we have started to see our intakes increase, but they're still not to pre-COVID numbers. So there is still plenty of capacity available with both us and Family and Children's here locally in the community. One of the things that we are putting a lot of attention on right now is children. We're working with the school districts. As you know, we have satellite clinics in many of the school districts in the county. And so we're working with them to figure out what access we will have to the students, whether it will be on campus or virtual. And then we're trying to make space at our facility on Green Street at the mental health department for those students that might not be returning to school, or for situations where we're unable to go to the school or reach the student while they're at school. We want to have a place for them to come and seek care, because it has been problematic, particularly for younger children, to try to engage virtually via video or teleconference. So we are really prioritizing that access right now as schools begin to reactivate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you, Frank. Martha?
Thanks very much. Thanks, Henry, for asking about law enforcement. Amy, I might have missed something. You said 34 responses altogether. That was since when?
Martha, that is the past week. Since we started this, we've had 68 calls come in. So there was definitely an uptick in the past week.
Okay. And 28 in the city.
Yes.
My math says that's more than 82%, where the city is roughly 30% of the population. I hope we are sending those statistics to all common council members on a regular basis. I would ask that we do that. A question for Jason. Your COVID-related expenses, almost $409,000. How much of that is reimbursable with FEMA?
That's a good question. You know, we don't know. The truth of the matter is we don't know. I know Amy's working with Dewar right now. I think Amy just sent a communication out this week to all department heads to be ready to sit down with our Deputy Director of Emergency Response to start to sift through expenses, pulling invoices, and then really starting, because we put a special accounting code so we can identify them. The truth is, I don't know. You know, in a perfect world, it'd be 75%, and then another perfect world, Governor Cuomo would kick in another 12.5. So we'll see where that comes from. You know, obviously, we're going to try to do all the due diligence we can to get as much reimbursement as we can. There's probably also some personnel numbers that might be able to be reimbursed, but we have to still sift through you know, the FEMA regulatory environment to know what that is. We'll submit as much as we can, and we'll see what we get back. And that is not – that number right there does not include anything for the testing site. Obviously, the testing site just got started today.
So we haven't actually submitted anything yet for FEMA reimbursement?
No, we're going through – there will be multiple submissions, and the community testing will be on its own submission, probably not tied to anything else.
Okay, and thank you. Just as an update, that people might remember that the HEROES Act that was passed in the House of Representatives includes that 25% for COVID-related FEMA expenses. That bill would pick up the full cost. Another thing we can dream about might, you know. Okay. And the town halls, I'm really glad you're highlighting other kinds of, you know, particular services. I hope you'll include the nonprofits in there, like FoodNet, transportation, and certainly DSS would be one of those departments that you know, should be accessible to the public too.
Yep. Yeah, we did have some discussion today about what nonprofits and the future town halls we should involve.
Great. And 211 especially, they've been a big part of all this. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to take these last two comments. Rich John, Anna Kellis. Okay, three. And then Mike Lane.
Thank you, Leslie. And Jason, thank you to you and your team. You know, we've seen this report updated meeting after meeting. It has been a very long haul, and I appreciate the work all of you have done on this. I would echo what Deborah said. I won't repeat it, but it just seems like trying to adopt something closer to the Onondaga model would serve the community pretty well. And I think it can be done while preserving privacy. I hope we take another look at that. And then just for the viewing public, my district, the 4th district of the county legislature, includes East Hill and Collegetown. I've been doing a lot of walking around and just observing what's happening there. I believe the great majority of the students are complying with their social compact that they signed, and that they're taking, you know, real precautions to prevent transmission of this disease. There is a percentage that is absolutely ignoring this. You know, the number of calls to 273-8000 has gone up weekend by weekend pretty significantly. 34 calls is a record. I mean, it's good people are calling, but there's a reason people are calling, and there's a reason that the vast majority of these calls are in the city. I have been communicating with my colleagues on Common Council that represent the Collegetown area. I sure would like to see a consistent, coordinated response, including Cornell Police and the city police, and perhaps IC police if there's Ithaca College students on South Hill, so that we're all reacting in the same way. It's very good that the sheriff has stood up and is carrying the water on this, but there's a lot to do, and it's urgent that we're doing it in real time. I am very worried that this could spiral out of control very quickly, going from almost none to 9 to 21. Those aren't the numbers we want to see. And you don't need to go very far to get to 100, and the governor is going to start talking about Tompkins County and the schools here, and we do not want that conversation to happen. I'm just very nervous. I think we need to do a full court press on this. I'm not saying issue tickets. I'm fine with the model where we go out and we educate and warn, but people who are blatantly violating these requirements to social distance and to protect each other need to know we're seeing it and need to know that it's not okay. This will not be ignored. Anyway, I'll stop my rant at that point, but thanks.
Thank you, Rich. I think you're sharing sentiments that many of us feel as well, so thank you. Anna Kellis.
Yeah, I would add my voice to support of Deborah's comments as well, along with Rich. The one thing that unique about Onondaga's data is the particular disaggregation. The categories would be much harder to do personal identification. So I think it's worth a look specifically because of that. Another comment, question I have for Frank. In public safety, we have been seeing a significant uptick as a result of COVID and quarantine in domestic violence. There's, of course, tremendous mental health, issues related to being a victim of domestic violence, of course, perpetrators as well. And I'm curious if there's been a discussion of mental health support, specifically outreach. I know the Advocacy Center has been doing work, but I'm curious what discussion there has been in the Department of Mental Health.
Yeah, we've had conversations amongst the mental health providers in the community. It's not just the county County Clinic about how we expand access to individuals and begin to try to find group opportunities as well. The Mental Health Association has been doing some outreach work. Quite frankly, there is a stigma associated with mental health services before COVID that still exists, and we have to try to move through to encourage anyone who feels like they just need someone to talk to reach out. And we've tried to provide that information on where those services are available. They're on the health department website. They're on the mental health department website. I know NAMI, the local NAMI chapter, has been sharing that information with their groups that they've been having. So we are trying to get the word out that services are available. There is still the challenge of the stigma that is unfortunate that we really need to work through and try to encourage folks to seek help before it becomes a crisis situation.
Right, and I think it's particularly problematic with this population because it can provoke violence doing outreach itself. So something I know is a challenge. The last thing that I wanted to mention, Jason, with respect to the town halls, I think that just a suggestion, it might be really worthwhile to have a focus on workforce development. Right now we have, 10% of our population has applied for unemployment. That's 10,000 people. Just let that number sink in for everybody. 10,000 people of our population of just over 100,000 have applied for unemployment. And I know I've heard, I don't know about my colleagues, but certainly a lot of questions about what support, retraining jobs. We're talking about that a lot in HED, but I know your town halls are widely viewed, so that might be a way of doing outreach. And the other thing that that we're seeing as a result, and we can expect to probably, I think, more, that's the expectation, is a need for food. There's an increase in food insecurity as a result of job loss and a reduction in the PUA and the expectation that that will go away before we have a vaccine. So it might be worthwhile talking a bit about what resources there are and how the county is involved with respect to that. I know you updated that website, and thank you so much. Those certainly could be combined into a town hall. So just a suggestion. Yep.
Well, I don't want to give a spoiler alert, but, we were talking about Workforce Development, DSS, and another nonprofit that works around child care as one of maybe our next guest appearances. So,
pull the words out of my mouth, Jason.
Yeah, we've had that conversation. It was either today or yesterday about what the next one will entail. So I totally agree with all the points there. We'll get them on.
Thank you, Jason.
Yep.
Thank you all for the suggestions, but, just I see Mike. But just a reminder, we have some talented people who work for us, and just the same way we're thinking, they're thinking as well. Mike Lane, last comment?
Well,
question.
I guess mine's more of a question for Frank. We're hearing about the potential of this double whammy, which is the advent of the regular flu season that we have and the need for people to get vaccinated for flu, because that with the COVID is extra dangerous. The flu kills lots of people every year, probably more than COVID. I'm not sure of that, but I think that's what I've heard. I wondered what the health department is going to be doing to raise awareness of the need for flu shots. Are we going to be sponsoring more flu clinics, for example? How do we get the young people in the schools that aren't being taken to their doctors to be vaccinated? How are we going to work for those? Because young children are often susceptible to flu and often carry it. So I'm concerned about the flu as well as COVID.
Yeah, those are all great points, Mike. And So let me work in backwards order. As far as vaccinations for children, flu and all childhood vaccinations are still required for school participation, even if it's virtual. And so we have been working with the local pediatric offices to make sure that, you know, they're available and ready, and they are. Dr. Klapek, our medical director, recorded a PSA that should be going out shortly if it hasn't already about the need for vaccination. So we're working on that. We're also working with the pediatric offices to support the small number of children that we provide vaccines to at the health department, just simply because we don't have the capacity right now with all of the COVID work that we're doing, and they've been very receptive. And quite frankly, it's really better if we can get children connected with a healthcare provider to get their vaccines than just doing it once a year with us. But we will make sure that any child that needs a vaccine can get a vaccine. Flu specifically, yes, we are going to do more messaging about flu. We actually received a small increase in our immunization grant from the state to be able to support flu vaccination efforts. And so we will be putting together an informational campaign. Dominic, Sam Hilson from the health department and the PIO group will be looking at what we can do to get the message out about that. What I will tell you is that the health department over the last probably 7 to 9 years has started to we've moved away from doing direct vaccination of flu because it's so readily available in our community and in almost every pharmacy, and so it's really it really wasn't a need for us. So we're not a provider of flu shots in the community, but we very much are an advocate and will be communicating about the importance, particularly this season, because of COVID.
Okay.
Thank you. We are going to move on. Oh, wait a minute. There's Annie. Annie, I just saw your hand.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond actually to one thing that Mike Lane said. I believe he mentioned that he thought possibly the flu kills more people than COVID. And maybe our health, maybe Frank can address that.
It did not this year in this flu season.
It's usually about 30 or 40,000 a year. Is that correct?
It can get upwards of 100,000, but there have been more COVID deaths this year than flu deaths.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne.
All right. Thank you all. Thank you for the COVID report, as usual. Anything else from you, Jason?
I just, if you'd like, I can just give a brief just overview of some budget items that more of the unknowns that we don't know, but I just want to go over a few things real quick, and if that's all right with you.
Yep.
Just to mention, there was a question earlier with the town of Ithaca, and has the town been impacted by everything? And I would say, generally speaking, towns and villages are having less of an impact, primarily because of what Rod said. So they're less dependent on sales tax. Most of your towns do the sales tax credit, which means in your jurisdiction, if they take that credit, they don't actually receive any of the revenue. It means your residents have a decreased county tax rate, which may change. You'll get a double whammy, so to speak, because not only did you not receive as much this year, but you'll have a decreased number next year. So sales tax doesn't necessarily always impact towns. The other thing to keep in mind is we make whole the towns and villages their tax levy. So they generally see no negative impact to delinquent tax payments. And that's usually their largest revenue source. So in general, fees, and they may see some decreased hits too, and they may see increases in other costs like retirement and some other fixed costs. But generally, the two entities hit hardest are going to be cities and counties, primarily because sales tax is a major portion of their budgets. Not always, but generally speaking, just understand that there will be a distinct difference most likely in the way towns and villages are dealing with these issues compared to cities and counties. As far as a few other items, just to mention, appreciate, we had some discussion earlier, and Mark will talk about a little bit about pushing back the budget intro to the 14th of September. We're waiting on some information that I think is relevant. Primarily, retirement rates should be coming out this week, which will change our fringe calculation, which we think will be important
And generally, we get a sneak peek as to what we think is going to happen or what the comptroller's office is going to tell us what's going to happen. That really hasn't happened this year. So a change in 1 to 2 or 3 percentage points could mean a decent bit change from a fringe perspective. So we're going to – we want to wait to that, incorporate that into the proposed budget, and that's going to require some more pushback. Also, we'll also get some more updated information. And right now, every week we're learning more things about variables that impact the budget. Sales tax, one thing I just want to mention about sales tax, it's still questionable, although we're seeing better sales tax, meaning it's not as negative as it was in the prior month. One thing to note that I did pay attention to is that the last NYSAC report that was sent out, they identified March, April, May sales compared to the same time last year, and they did it by county. And something that was interesting that stuck out, I mean, I don't know, maybe I caught it before, just forgot it, but Tompkins County was the third worst on there in terms of statewide compared to all the rest of the counties. Meaning our sales tax, our sales dropped the most, third most, compared to the rest of the counties between March and May sales compared to 2019. A big part that I can only attribute that to would be probably because the students in higher ed been released and there was not graduation during that time. Just the reason I bring that up is there's too much of a correlation to think that that's not the case. I think that as very much is the case and probably has a big part to do with it. And just to kind of show you the variable that that plays in our local economy. So we'll continue to monitor sales tax. And obviously, every more information we get about it, the better it is if we can put a projected number for next year. State aid is a big unknown. So we're trying to, put a most likely an increased contingency in the budget that will account for some decrease in state aid, which I think is most likely inevitable at this point of the game. And that's what a lot of colleagues across the state, as I'm talking to them, as they're starting to put their budget together, how they're trying to address that. The capital plan, we're trying to keep as much of the capital plan intact as we can, but don't be surprised if some things are pushed back or put back a few more years on the schedule because of some of the revenue shortages. The only thing I have to add to that is NYSAC, Dave Lucas from NYSAC reached out to me because we usually have our budget done before most folks, which we still will in this case. He's asked me to present on our budget process and our proposed budget approach at the webinar, I believe, on September 15th for NYSAC. So I'll be one of three panelists, and we'll probably go through our budget, the budget presentation that would have just provided you the night before on the 14th. Aside from that, just want to say, again, compliment the staff and the hard work they've done. Frank, Amy, Dominic, and the EOC, they've been remarkable. Last week was kind of a turbulent week. There were highs, there were lows, seemed to pick up a lot more. Public health nurses have seen some increased activity, a lot of increased activity. My compliments go to them for their committed work, their hard work that they're doing. Jay Franklin, it continues to be a support in EOC. Our PIO team, again, folks that have been dispatched from other departments continue to support Dominic and Sam and the PIO initiatives, which I think are huge in terms of our ability to communicate with the public. And obviously ITS, who just continues to make major lifts. And they're down a few staff members as well as they're trying to support everybody remotely. So, you know, we're going on more than a 6-month cycle without a break, so to speak. And these folks have been working incredibly hard. So I just want to thank them again and compliment them for their dedication and hard work. I know there's more people that I haven't mentioned, but they're working hard. They're prepared for the past week, the next few weeks, and what we may see an uptake in cases. Hopefully not, but if we do, they're ready for it. So I just want to compliment them again. That's all I have, Leslie.
Thank you, Jason. Yes, Amanda, definitely, you know, big ups, good cheers to all of them. And, yeah, I want to just add very quickly to what you said, Jason, to the employee recognition lunch. Thanks very, very much to HR, especially Heather Buck, you know, Lisa and the whole team down there and all the work in the highway department for hosting the legislators who, you know, showed up to help, you know, hand out some lunches. It was a great event, and I, you know, it was a small way of letting our employees know that despite everything that's going on, we value and appreciate them hanging in there and keeping Tompkins County going. Okay, Martha and Henry, I see your hands. Are these absolute questions you got to ask? And I mean questions. Okay, question, Martha.
The Health Insurance Consortium, do you have the numbers there yet for their premium?
I don't. They're going to vote on the 25th, but I think what we're going to do is budget what we think is going to be the percentage increase, which will probably be around 5%. I don't think it will be more than that. If it's less, that's an adjustment that I'm more than willing to accept after we propose the budget. So I think we'll be safe at a 5% increase.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Martha. Henry, question?
Yes.
Is it a question?
Yes, Jason, do you have any idea about the open meetings law that the governor is going to exempt from?
I don't. In general, we don't know until the night before. I'm going to guess again that it's going to be continued.
All right. Thank you, Jason, for your report. Appreciate it. I'm looking at the time. I just want to ask Rick and Jonathan, do you have any reports for us before we take a break? Anything from you, Jonathan?
Only 1 minute. Just wanted to tell people that court looks like it's continuing to be largely remote for a period of time. In fact, they're changing from Skype to Microsoft Teams, which indicates that they expect to be having remote appearances for quite some time moving forward.
Okay. Thank you, Jonathan. Rick, do you have a report?
Yes, I do. I have a highlights of the 2019 financial annual statement. Financial.
All right, Rick, what I would do is take a break and then come back and get to your report, okay? We'll start with you when we come back. So why don't we go ahead and break until, I can't even see the time, I'd say 7:50 at this point, 7:50, and we'll be back at that time. Thank you. We are coming back from recess, resuming our meeting. Please let me know that you are there, that we have a quorum. I see Deborah. I see Dan and Mike. I see Glenn. Wonderful. Thank you all very much. I think we do have a quorum. We're going to go ahead and get started. Rick Schneider.
Great to see you this evening.
Nice to see you, too.
I'd like to present our 2019 financial report to you this evening. Final audited financial report you have all received, and I've supplied copies to the legislative clerk, which I'm required to do by law, and I've made sure that you each got an email copy. The financial report is that email that you've seen where there were five documents attached. Now, just one of those is the actual financial report or financial statements, and there's a couple of letters that are attached. And another one of them is the executive summary, which is a small, concise version of the financial report, if you just want to flip through a few pages. So this is the same thing that the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee members each received, and they sat through the auditor's presentation of the financial report for 2019, and that was back on August 19th. And I've prepared a short presentation for tonight that covers some things that they just don't cover. And I also added to the agenda tonight a resolution, which the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee has approved for the legislature to approve tonight. And that simply accepts the financial statements. As I said in my emails to you a number of times, that executive summary, management discussion and analysis, which is in the front of the financial report, are probably the shortest little summaries for you to read that really bring out the highlights for the fiscal year. That's a good place for you to start reading if you don't want to read the hundreds of pages in those five documents. And as with all previous years' financial reports and budgets, we will be making this available on the county's website. So I'm going to share screen here and first look at the independent auditor's report. Are you seeing that now?
Yes.
The independent auditor's report is page one of the financial report, and it says that we received an unmodified opinion on the basic financial statements, and it's also an unmodified opinion on the schedule of expenditures of federal awards for the year ended December 31st, 2019. That's the highest or best level of opinion that you can get from the auditors. That actual opinion part of the letter is down here on the second page where it talks about how they cast their opinion. And I wanted to bring that to your attention because without that, you can pretty much kiss goodbye your good and healthy credit rating with Moody's and a lot of the other things that we have to do to support our controls here on our financial statements. There's another letter at the end of the financial report called the Independent Auditor's Report on Internal Control over Financial Reporting and on Compliance and Other Matters based on an audit of financial statements performed in accordance with government auditing standards. That's back on page 75 of the actual financial report. But what it says in that letter is very important also. It says that the report identifies no material instances of noncompliance and no material internal control weaknesses. So I thought I'd share that with you from that part of the document. And now I want to go back to another document. And I'm not sure how to do that. Drew, can you help me?
Stop share.
Yeah, I want to stop sharing on this. Oh, here we go. Is it new share?
Yep. And share again.
And then go to this.
Yep.
Okay.
There you go. You got it.
Now, are you looking at a PowerPoint presentation?
No. No. It's got to be a stop share.
Same screen.
Yes. Here. Perfect. And now we want to go over to the screen. Share screen. Yep.
Pardon me while I get used to driving here. How about now?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. You got that.
Highlights. I've just covered the unmodified opinion, which I think is the most important part of it, and the report on internal control. What the auditors don't talk about a whole lot is looking at the specific funds, as the legislators like to look at specific funds. They tend to look at the more overall financial statements for the county. But I wanted you to see that the general fund recorded an increase of $4.7 million, ending the year with a fund balance of $54.3 million. Of this, $46.2 million was unassigned. One of the other things we talk about a lot is sales tax. For 2019, we came in at $2.4 million over budget, and that was similar to 2018, where we came in about $2.9 million over budget. Just and casino revenue came in at $0.8 million over budget. That's $800,000. And the year before, we came in $800,000 over budget also. You can see a graph of our sales tax collections here. And from 2012 to 2019, those are all actual figures. So every one of these bars up to 2019 is the actual receipts. You can see for 2019, we came in at $38,730,000. The projection here, at first I wasn't going to share it because we have about 10 different projections. I went with a very projection here for 2020. If you go up to the top of the bar, that shows that we would come in at $34.4 million, which is 3.3 $4 million less than budget. That purple area there is what we would be coming in less than budget. And I know that's very optimistic. That's based on basically a minus 6% on each of the last 5 months of the year. And I know that could be very different. I've heard numbers anywhere from a negative $2 million up to negative $12 million. So I'm not really wanting you to concentrate too much on this 2020 projection, but you can see the steady growth in sales tax from 2016 up to 2019. One of the things the auditors do a pretty good job at explaining is the overall financial statements or the county's net position as a whole. Within that comprehensive look at the county as a whole, you have what we call the government activities. This is most of our funds called government activities. It doesn't include enterprise fund or trust funds or some of the odd funds. But when you look at a comprehensive overall approach, you can see that government activities went from $121.3 million to $132.7 million, and of this amount, $36,399,000 was an unrestricted deficit. Why is it a deficit? Well, it's primarily a result of a recognition of some huge liabilities, mostly for OPEB or other liabilities other than pension, and that would be our retiree health care liability over a long period of time, and of course the pension liabilities. If you subtract out those two liabilities, you're back up to a positive positive figure for our net investment overall. So I wanted you to be aware of the fact that there's two big numbers that drastically affects and produces this unrestricted deficit. On the good side of it, the net investment in capital assets increased by $20.9 million, or 14.75%. And a year-to-year analysis on the net position is shown in the financial statements on page 4D, figure 1. Again, looking at the county as a whole, the government activities had revenues of $217 million compared to $190.4 million the year before, and that's an increase of $26.6 million. Government activities had expenses of $205.6 million compared to $193.5 million the year before, an increase of $12.1 million. And one of the things that takes quite a bit of time for the auditors to do with this is what we call the single audit. The single audit looks at federal grants that reimburse us for qualified programs, and that single audit is in the very last section of the financial statement. So if you go to like the last six pages or so, you can find the single audit. The single audit reports federal award programs in the amount of $28.6 million for year 2019. This chart shows our investment in capital assets over 7 years. And in most years, from 2011 right up to 2018, it's been pretty consistent. The assets, these are our fixed assets like bridges, roads, and buildings, and it's usually between $10, $15 million a year, which we purchase and add to our books as capital assets. But in 2019, you see it spiked up to $40.4 million. So along with all the roads and bridges and facilities that we normally by a year. This includes the airport infrastructure that's been added. So you know that that project there is about a $30 million project that got booked last year. So that's why that number spiked so high, to showing that our investment in capital assets grew by $40.4 million in 2019. The constitutional debt limit for the county is a question that often comes up. The lines at the top, the green and the yellow lines at the top, show our total outstanding bonded indebtedness and the debt subject to debt limit. Those lines are almost exactly the same because the debt subject to debt limit is usually the same. It's a financial calculation. So you can see up here at the top part that we're at $54.91 million for debt. That goes with this axis going up and down the left-hand side of your screen. So that's what that shows our level of debt. And it stays pretty much the same from year to year. Gone down a year before, then it comes back up in 2019. So our debt doesn't really change that much from year to year, although it does tend to go up ever so slightly. At the bottom portion of this graph, it shows you the percentage, debt as a percentage of debt limit. And we are currently at 10.8%. So that means 90% of our, we're only at 10%. That leaves another 90% that we could still borrow without hitting that limit. And that number as a percent has not changed that much since 2013. It's gone from 10 to 11 to 12%. Right now we're at about 11% of our debt limit. It's a very good sign, a very good signal. Now we look at the general fund. I like to show this because it shows the red lines is the growth in our revenues. The blue lines is the growth in our expenditures. Our expenditures in all these slides include transfers out to other funds. So here you can see in 2019, our revenues are very, very high at $190 million. Expenditures in the general fund were $185 million. The yellow bars at the bottom represents our fund balance. You can see our fund balance grew in 2019, $46,200,000. And that's the unassigned portion of our fund balance. So when we talk about what do we have that's left, that's unassigned, it's these yellow bars here. And they've been growing ever since 2011, 2012, and they keep going up. And we're going to look at a couple other slides on fund balance, but I wanted to show you that this growth in fund balance is, it has helped us to not only maintain our really good bond rating, but sets us in much better shape than most governmental entities for a crisis such as what we're in right now. Trying to get through this fiscal year, budgeting for next year, fiscal year 2021. Here's the increases in our unassigned fund balance over the last 7 years. Working up from the bottom, in 2013, the increase was $1,461,000. 2014, it was up $4,444,000. And we ride up into the most current year here in 2019, our unassigned balance grew $4,830,000. So those are all very positive increases in your fund balance over a seven-year period. That total I've marked here at the bottom totals $28 million. That's how much your general fund balance has increased in 7 years. What size should our fund balance be? We had a very lengthy discussion on this last year. I won't take the time to review all those slides from last year, but it brings us down to just one or two comments I like to say. What should your fund balance be? Well, the GFOA recommends at a minimum that no less than two-thirds or 2 months of the regular general fund operating revenues, or 16.7%. That's two months out of 12. So that's one source. That doesn't tell you what it has to be. That's just one of the government sources that emphasizes you really shouldn't have less than 2 months of reserves. Currently, our fund balance policy says we're at 10%. Last year, as a result of having a meeting just like this, Jason and I began working on a new fund balance policy, and we got interrupted with COVID-19 and a lot of other pressures. As we dust that off and begin to take serious bringing that back to you in the next couple of months, we probably will be recommending changing our general fund balance policy to a range, not just one number, but up from 10% to a range of 18 to 23%. Now let's look at where we're at. If we look at where we're at, the current undesignated fund balance as a percentage of general fund budget revenue is at 23.8%. If you look over the last couple of years, it hasn't changed very much at all. You go from 23.7 in 2017 to 24% in 2018 to 23.8%. So it really hasn't changed that much at all. And if you're curious, what does just 1% of fund balance equal to? 1% of budgeted revenues is equal to $1,940,000, so roughly $2 million. So for every 1% change in your fund balance, it's going to go up or down by about $2 million. A page from the book shows right here all the fund balances, and I won't go over each and every one of these, but this is at 2018 and 2019, when you're looking at the general fund, again, went up $4.7 million for the general fund. The county road fund, which is the second line there, went down about a million one. And why is that? Why would the county? Well, that was something that was designed on purpose over the last two or three years. We saw that the defund balances, or the road and highway fund balance, was going up, and we wanted to use some of that for bridging roads projects. So as a legislature, over the last couple of years, you've seen many budget resolutions come before you where we've taken money from the road and highway fund balance to make up the difference for some road projects that either went over budget or we were trying to pay our local portion of it without going out to debt. So it was a conscientious and planned and predictable behavior that made us use this $1.1 million in the county road fund. The transportation or airport fund had a very good year. They went up $406,000 in their fund balance. Solid waste, even though we thought as we approached year last year in December that it was going to be losing money, there were a few more grants that came in that were booked. And lo and behold, they came up with a profit or net income of $342,000, where their fund balance increased at recycling materials and management fund. And again, I won't go over each of these. The biggest number is the capital projects transportation fund went down $17 million. So my gosh, how can your fund balance go down to a negative number, a negative 13. Well, that represents that $13 million worth of bands that we floated for the airport project. The bands show up as a liability in our books, not as a revenue. So because it's not really a revenue until we actually float bonds or receive other revenues for the project, that brings down the fund balance to this negative $13 million. And, of course, all the other funds are rolled up, like debt service fund, road machinery fund. They all have fund balances. This page comes directly out of the financial report. Here we're looking at the road fund, which I just described to you. The balance as of the end of 2019, this yellow fund balance is $745,000.
There it is.
You can see the use of the expenditures here in the last 4 years exceeded the revenues in the defund. We budgeted it this way on purpose so that we slowly start to use up some of that fund balance. So that's why you see, although the revenues are going up, the expenditures go up a little bit higher. So that forces the fund balance in the road fund to consistently come down almost every year since 2014. Transportation fund, which is our airport fund, the unassigned fund balance as of the end of 2019 for the airport is $1,255,000. The airport's revenues for the year, right here, this red mark, were $3,474,000 compared to expenditures of $3,067,000. So that resulted in a net profit of $406,000 for the airport. So when you add that to what the existing fund balance, you can see the last 3 years, the airport has grown their fund balance to where they used to have it. Balance back in 2013 and 14, they now have a positive fund balance, and that's up to $1,250,000. The solid waste fund or recycling and materials management fund, the revenues for this particular fund was $6.3 million, and the expenditures was $5.9 million. And that resulted in a net profit of $342,000. So the yellow bars, which designates their unassigned fund balance, grew to about $2.1 million. That's what they have to work with going into this next budget year, 2021. Yes, this fund, the solid waste fund, is a little bit more erratic than most of the other funds, and that's because even though the revenues pretty much track, you can see where they go up and down, and that happens to be whenever you implement a fee increase, that's when the red lines jump up again, and then you might not do a significant fee increase for another year or two, and then it jumps up again. But here the expenditures are a little bit more uneven, and it's a challenge going forward with this fund. Because as you know, there's a huge RFP that's out right now. We've got a response. There's just been one response to that bid, and Barb and a committee will be bringing that back to the legislature, letting us know, well, what is it in that RFP that we're going to do, and what is it that we're not going to be able to do. So it's a challenge with the solid waste fund, but at least the is they're not totally out of fund balance like we thought they might have been a year or two ago. And that's pretty much the end of my report. I'd like to take your questions if you have any at this time.
Here's three.
Thank you, Rick. I can't see anybody. You have to stop sharing your screen.
Okay.
Don't stop sharing this, Hannah. Y'all go to those pages for Hannah.
If you have a question for Rick, somebody jump in because I can't see you, and then while I see you, I'll call.
Oh, so you don't want me to do it?
My internet is a bit spotty, Leslin, so I just texted. I put in the chat, and that's what Drew is talking about. Questions, but Drew answered the one question, which is that the overall revenue increase and expenditure increase that was pretty substantial is a one-time due primarily to the airport. I just wanted to make sure that was noted because I don't want people to think, oh my God, our our size of government and the cost of government is exploding, because that's not the case. But the other question.
Thank you, Anna.
And the other question is in the chat. Rick.
Yeah. Is the capital assets investment all local share? No. The capital assets is not being spent, but that involves all sources of revenue, whether it's bonds, whether it's federal government, state, all sources of revenue. That's what we book as the capital assets, that which was expended, the expenditure side of it.
Great. Thank you.
And then you had asked, revenues and expenditures increased, but how much of this increase was local? Well, that's the one we just spoke
of. Yes. So I think that you hit everything. Thank you.
Okay.
Rick, thank you very much. That was a nice comprehensive report. Gave us a really good overview of where we are with our finances. Really, seriously, thank you. And it was all colorful and everything. Oh, I loved it.
I wanted to thank Drew Brayman and Joanne Carruthers for working through. This was their first year audit for them to work entirely through it from beginning to end. This was their first year producing financial statements and all these reports. And it's been, they'll tell you, it's been a real challenge. It's been a real fun experience. He's still smiling, so I guess not only did they learn a lot, but we were able to bring you a report that is quite positive. And I think set you on stage now next for looking into the very hardest thing that you have to do is enter in into Jason's quagmire of budgeting. But I think this sets a stage in a positive light so that you can move forward into the next year, 2021. And maybe this
very timely and really good choice of words. Quagmire, yes. Thank you, and thanks to the entire finance team. That was really well
received. Thanks to all of them.
Anne Foreman, you have a question?
Thank you. Thank you for the report, Rick. And so I attended the audit presentation, and I believe, so please correct me if I heard this correctly, we discussed that if we wanted to have a drawdown of the general unassigned fund balance, you know, if we went through a pandemic and a financial crisis, if we wanted to use some of that over the next few years, that might not hurt our ratings. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, we talked about a lot of the factors that are involved. But yes, planned use of fund balance, even in a pandemic and going forward as we were planning to use reserves for capital projects going forward into the future. If you can establish that you have a good plan, it doesn't hurt to use your fund balance as long as you don't go to far extremes.
Thank you.
I give them any ideas, Rick. Martha?
Yeah, to follow up on that, we discussed, you know, what about using, you know, should we be deferring capital projects? Is this a bad time to spend? And basically, the auditors really said, really advised that if these are projects you know you're going to do, mm-hmm. it's a good time to do. You know, interest rates are so low, and it's a good time to go ahead and spend the money. But you know, just not to go out on a limb that you weren't planning to go out on anyway.
But you're right. The debt right now, if we were going out to debt right now, it would be probably some of the lowest rates on a debt offering if we were to go right now for some long-term borrowing. And even till this coming February, who knows what the market will do between now and February, which is when our next debt borrowing will be. But these are historically low interest rates, the lowest, and the Fed is not prepared to move anywhere off of this zero interest rate environment anytime soon. So we are in an extremely good position for doing our regular borrowing that we would normally do at this time. And that should be for the programs and the projects that you feel are the ones that you just shouldn't put off, the ones that you can't put off. There's other projects. As Jason said, we might be bumping out a couple projects a few years. There's other projects that aren't projects that are, I'm not going to say they're not as important, but they're not as necessary that have to be done. Like you have to do certain road and bridge projects and things like that for public safety. So you'll see some movement even now in the capital planning as we move projects. Some projects might be moved out and others that we'll go ahead with based on this current interest rate environment being so favorable.
Do you think, do you still think it's a good time to review the fund balance policy and talk about increasing it from 10 to 18 or 23?
Yeah, Jason and I have met on this a number of times over the last couple months, and we almost had it put together 6 months ago, and the last things that we had to do is put those actual percentages down, not just for the general fund, but each fund gets its own percentage assigned to it on what we think it needs to have. And we pretty much got that done. And what we had to spend time doing is writing a section near the end that tells you as a legislator what happens if you exceed that threshold, that range, or what happens if you fall below that range. We wanted to put some remedial actions in there that would, well, not, I don't want to say automatic, but there would be guidelines set so that this is what you should do when you fall outside the range of fund balance. And we were almost done with putting it together before we fell into all turned upside down. But I still think Jason would like to bring this to you pretty much at the same time as adopt our budget for next year. Is that right, Jason?
Yeah, I think now's a good time to update it, to be honest with you. It gives some more guiding principles. You know, we're going to use the fund balance is going to, so several things about fund balance, while the number has increased from year to year, Rick showed that slide where the percentage has stayed relatively flat, and that is because every year your budget size is increasing and fund balance percentage is based off of the fund balance and a percentage of, I think, expenditures, annual expenditures. So as annual, it's either expenditures or revenue. I forget what that was.
It's revenues, but yeah.
Revenues, I'm sorry. So in that case, as revenues increase every year, your to be 23% is a higher value, dollar value in future years. One thing to keep in mind is the proposed 21 budget will most likely be less than the 20 budget in terms of actual budget size. So your the amount of fund balance needed to maintain a certain percentage will be less as well, which is probably a good thing because we're going to need some of it. So I think it's a good time to review it now. It's at 10% now, which is even low compared to general GFLA standards. The 18 to 22 mark where Rick and I discussed makes a lot of sense for a variety of reasons because these things fluctuate and you should have a reasonable range. That's a safe range. The part we talked about, which I think is really important from your perspective, is, all right, what happens when we dip below that? What's the plan? Or who, you know, we put forward a plan, I put forward a plan for you on how to build it up over future years. So that means you maintain, you know, your fiscal solvency. And then what Rick mentioned earlier about what happens when you exceed it. You know, what are some of the, how does that frame that discussion about, you know, keeping it in that range? So I think it's a good time. We're going to revisit this once we get the proposed budget together and hopefully bring it to you better at the end of the year. But the 18 to 22% range is where we were feeling comfortable about a general fund, unassigned fund balance range.
Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you. Anna, you have a question?
Just a quick question, Jason. So the, briefly, the $4.5 million that was more than expected from 2019, that could have been used to push us to the higher end of that 18 to 23%, but that will be used to counter the deficit that we've experienced this year. How is that going to balance out?
Well, so, for example, we had a good, it was a $4.7 million, I think, the unassigned fund balance grew as a result of 2019, which is a great thing. It's a good thing to have that ability of growth. Unfortunately, your operating deficit at the end of 20 will probably be around that or larger. So, to the extent that we were able to grow that fund balance is good. Unfortunately, because expenditures will exceed revenues in 20, the closure of the fiscal year 2020 statements will probably see a drop in fund balance as a result of expenditures exceeding revenues.
But if we were at 16% of the fund balance at the end of last year, ideally we would have been able to take some of this money to add it to it so that we would be between the 18 and 22, 23 range. Yeah. But we could stay at the 16%, use the 4.5, 4.7 fund balance increase to offset the deficit of this year so that it is potentially a net wash. Correct? Is that
essentially what you're saying is going to happen by default because your expenditures are going to exceed your revenue. So yes, exactly what you're saying is going to happen. Your percentage of fund balance, I'd have to look again on how we would compute that. I will, in the proposed budget, probably have a page or two on fund balance projections to show you what the deficit of the year, estimated deficit of the year, will do to your fund balance. And if you use some fund balance in the 21 budget, what that may look like. So I'll do some new, probably a new page or two to kind of explain it. It's hard without showing it.
I might add that last year at this time, we had a slide in the presentation that showed uses that were planned for the next 2 years. And we were not able to provide that for you in this presentation like we did last year because we were much further along with the budgeting process last year at this point in time. So not until we put the budget together for 2021 can we really show you where the next 2 years' effect will be on fund balance. We should be able to show you at least by the end of this calendar year, I'd say, what 2020 has wrought, what it looks like, what it's going to pretty much feel like, and what 2021 will affect on your fund balance, because in fact you will have just adopted a budget.
Right, but Jason, you're going to include in this if our total budget decreases, of course, then by default the percent of our fund balance, if it stays the same, would actually go up as a percentage. So you're going to add into your presentation that adjustment. Okay, great. So, thanks.
And I'll probably do it with all the fund balances of the different funds, because this is getting into a bigger capital discussion, but Rick and I have talked about some of the smaller capital projects using some of the fund balance and some of the smaller funds like the deep fund or the capital fund to help pay cash for capital for those rather than finance them. So I'm going to do a little bit of a different slide or a series of pages in the budget book on fund balance and fund balance projection.
Okay, it's coming. Thank you very much, everyone. Thanks again, Rick and Drew, finance team. Anything else from you, Rick?
All for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
And now we have, it's past 8:30. I was about to say we have 1 minute to finish the rest of the agenda, but it's already past 8:30, so never mind. And we did hear from Jonathan already. So moving on to standing and special committee reports and resolutions, starting with HED, Anna Kellis, chairperson.
We had four really amazing presentations. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go in depth. I will just note one of them was on housing, and we had the housing strategy that established goals a couple years ago. We have made some progress, but we have not reached those targets. We have not hit those targets year over year. And the burden, the rent burden or house burden on renters specifically has gone up, and it has gone down for homeowners. So the renter cost burden rate is higher than state and national averages in Tompkins County, and the homeowner cost burden rate is lower. So we are also particularly not hitting our mark with studio and four bedrooms in particular, and rentals, and particularly affordable housing. So that was one. We had a presentation from Kurt Anderson from TCAT. He gave a presentation on the economic impact of COVID. We also had a presentation from Natalie Bernoski, and that both of those, hers obviously was on workforce development, One thing that I wanted to note so that it is on record is that none of the federal stimulus packages have had any support for workforce development. And of course, that is a particularly huge need right now. In Tompkins County, the job loss has been the highest among the age group of under 25 years old. That is really interesting. And we need to, next year, our goal, not only is she going to be working on a workforce development strategy, but next year to bounce back from the impact that we've experienced this year, we would need to see, and the goal that's being established is 200 people back to work every week for 52 weeks. Next year. So anybody who's talking to state and federal electeds, getting stimulus funding specifically focused on workforce development is a huge need. The last presentation was broadband. Again, that is it has become very clear the need for universal broadband more than ever, and the inequity in broadband has come to the fore because of COVID. It's always been there, but it has really been brought to the fore with respect to rural. And so we had a presentation specifically from Jen Gregory from ST8. We are definitely getting our money's worth from that membership. Katie Borgella and I were talking about that today. She has done huge things for us in the county that we will continue to roll out and announce as they come through. But she had set up a meeting today with the Southern Tier Network, similar to the Healthcare Consortium. Southern Tier Network is a network of counties that have established a municipally owned, because it is nonprofit, owned by municipalities collectively, a regional municipally owned dark fiber, which is the middle fiber, which will go into communities and then reduce the total cost of connecting to that wire and building out if a municipality wants to build out. So last mile build out infrastructure of last mile is significantly reduced in price, and it also gives more ownership and power for municipalities to negotiate prices. So we met with STN today, and that was recorded. We'll share it with people, and I will reach out to TCOG to have that presentation happen there as well. And that conversation is just starting. So a lot of information. It was all recorded. Highly recommend people watch it if any of this interests you. And I have one agenda item.
Any questions for Anna on her report? Dan.
Yeah, Anna, thank you for helping bring attention to this issue. As you know, I've had lots of questions, and I'm starting to see if those questions are being addressed, so I really appreciate it. And Anna, I like what you said earlier, that the pandemic didn't create this problem, but it, you know, made it obvious to everybody else, kind of woke people. So those, you know, to the issue, those of us in the corners of the county that don't have broadband access, what a different class that puts us in. I do want to say that I just want to, you know, ring the alarm bell once again that the town of Lansing has formed its own broadband committee and has started meeting. The town of Danby has formed its own broadband committee, and they're kind of pausing, waiting to hear from us. Newfield Town Board spent an hour talking about it last week, about what they can do within their own town. And it just, to me, it really puts a spotlight on the need for leadership and coordination and communication, because for the last 7 years, the towns have been trying to do their own little broadband projects, and it really has not been very successful. That's why we need coordination and, you know, a larger group. So thank you for bringing a lot of good information to bear on this topic.
Thank you, Dan.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Thank you.
I definitely couldn't agree with you more, Dan. Absolutely. And I will continue to share all of the information that we're getting and try and do it as fast as possible.
Thanks, Anna. I have a question for you. I was trying to understand what you meant by the rent burden. You said the renters have more burden than the landlords now. Can you share a little bit more about what you mean by that?
No, not than the landlords, than homeowners.
Than homeowners. Okay.
Yep. Yep. So if we are looking at those two different groups, it's important to stratify them out. And if you're measuring how many residents are cost burdened, renters are significantly more cost burdened than homeowners are cost burdened by the amount. And that is actually the national standard of what is cost burden. What it means is that you are paying 30% or more of your total income for housing. And extremely rent burdened is 50% or more. And we actually have a substantial amount of both 30 and 50%. And our cost burden rate is higher than both New York State as well as national for renters. And for homeowners in Tompkins County, it is lower than both of those, both state and federal averages.
Thank you. I was looking for the numbers, and you did, and you just mentioned them. Thank you very much. Okay. Anything, Annie, you have a resolution, you said. Yes, resolution F.
Yep. So this was the last topic that was discussed, and it is to set a hearing. And the title, Scheduling a Public Hearing for Local Law Number Blank of 2020, a local law amending Local Law Number 4 of 1989, Tompkins County Hotel Room Occupancy Tax Law, amending the exemption in Section 150-12 of the Tompkins County Code. And this is ID 9495, and I will note that there is a report from Nick in the packet for HED that was exceptional, very comprehensive, explaining the shift in percent of people who are renting in the 10 rooms or less. That has increased significantly. So protecting that group as if it is under threat of not getting attention, which was the idea I'm summarizing in 1989, is no longer relevant today. So, and also a lot of the B&Bs are also double their listing on many of the short-term rentals. Some, not all, but some.
Okay, may I have a second on that, please? Seconded by Martha Robertson. Discussion, comments. It's just setting the public hearing. Okay. Henry.
Yes, I will be voting against this because although Nick has done a fine presentation, there's been no presentation to the Airbnb owners or anyone else, especially in the time of COVID, to figure out what the effect of this would be on their workings. So I'll be voting against it.
Okay. Thank you. Roll call vote.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
No.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
12 ayes, 1 no.
Okay, it carries, and just for record, that public hearing will be set for September 15th, 2020.
Thank you, everyone, and that is my full report.
Thank you, Anna. Complete census count committee, my claim chair.
We have not met since the last legislature meeting. We will meet again this month because of Labor Day. We'll meet on the 14th. That's a Monday at 9 o'clock. In the meanwhile, we've been doing some activities, certainly in coordination with Martha's Tiger Committee. Thanks for her leadership there. Trying to address the issue of the shortened period for the follow-up on reporting by those people who have not signed up and answered the questions online, from shortening the period from October 31st to back to September 30th. We think that that's likely to hurt us here because we're already behind in the number of people who are, who have submitted at this point in Tompkins County. We're behind the national average, and I think we're behind the state average. The we have been putting out some advertising, thanks to Dominic for coordinating that. As I've reported before, we have some on the buses, ads there are in the social media, and we now have some lawn signs out there for people, knowing that to tell them that it's not too late. They can still go online, 2020census.gov, and complete the 10 questions and become a part of helping us obtain the grant funding we're entitled to, helping us to have the representation in the Congress and the state legislatures and the county legislature that we're entitled to.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions, Mike? All right. Downtown Facilities Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you. Downtown Facilities has not met this month, and we will not be meeting this coming month either.
All right. Thank you, Dave. Any questions for Dave? No. Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. The Public Safety Committee met on August 20th, and we had a good meeting. We had some discussion of the response with the sheriff to the COVID-19 calls. We also talked about the beginning of the process for responding to the governor's executive order on police reform. And we also discussed a meeting between county representatives and city representatives to see about perhaps working together on that project. A lot to do there, but it was the start. It was encouraging. And we also discussed the jail population, which has gone up slightly. It seems to have held steady since our meeting in August. It's right at around 41 or 42. And there were multiple reasons for why that's happening, but it looks like it's roughly stabilized there for now. I'd also mentioned, Anna brought up the issue of domestic violence and domestic disturbance calls. One of the things we do at the Public Safety Committee is we review the 911 calls and the numbers. And indeed, there has been a consistent rise in domestic disturbance 911 calls over the past several months, which we're tracking. The sheriff and the advocacy center are responding to that, and there are for anybody who's struggling with that, there are resources available at all times to help, and certainly we would encourage anybody suffering from there to use those resources. The sheriff's office and local agencies really, really want to help. Other than that, I'm happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rich. Questions for Rich? Mike Lane?
Rich, I was certainly continue to be concerned about the COVID response that the sheriff has been on the sheriff's department's shoulders since we began looking at this, particularly with the report tonight about the number of complaints that are coming out of the city. Are we going to take a stance about the fact that the Ithaca City Police are not enforcing this? Jason, at his meeting with town and village representatives by telephone last Thursday, said that they were still continuing to refuse to respond to those calls. What does the committee want to do about it?
Well, I won't speak for the rest of the members of the Public Safety Committee, but my view is that as a county, we would be far better off if we had a coordinated and consistent response, and that each of the police agencies that's able to respond was willing to pitch in and to respond to these calls, especially in the neighborhoods that they're used to patrolling, that they know very well. the better we can educate and warn the public, probably far less serious consequences we'll see down the line. And it's a real-time issue. We should be addressing it. I agree with you, Mike. Jason, do you want to add anything?
I think you captured it, Rich. You know, we had multiple meetings leading up to a few weeks ago trying to get that coalition of effort. And, you know, you have some of the local PDs that have responded. Fuga Heights has responded to a few of them. Obviously, their coverage is a little more scattered just by the nature and the size of their departments. So, you know, when they're not available, we cover it under normal circumstances. But, you know, we needed a solution, and this was the solution that we came to when we could not when we couldn't get the city PD, when the city PD, you know, basically, you know, said they would not respond to these. So, while not ideal, we needed a solution. The sheriff, you know, we spoke with the sheriff. Sheriff says, you know, we got to do what we got to do. So that's where we're at right now.
Rich, I agree with you totally. It ought to be a coordinated response so that some of the villages are responding, as well as the sheriff. But apparently the city isn't. And that, to me, is not acceptable.
I have no good answer for you, Mike. I think that would be the responsible thing to do. I'm not going to argue with you.
Thank you, Rich.
Martha?
To follow that up, I think I remember, Jason, that you said that IPD did say that they would continue to respond to noise complaints. So what happens if they show up and there are 100 people and nobody's got masks on? Do they just talk about noise, or do they at least, since they're already there, know what the message is and how to communicate that about COVID?
Amy, do you want to take this answer, this question?
Sure, I can. So they're responding to the noise complaints. Sometimes the noise complaints do come with public health complaints as well. If they do have that, they use the same approach that the sheriff's department would. They, you know, start with the noise complaint, and then if they observe something, they fill out the exact same educational form. They fax that in. It goes to environmental health as well as to the institution if it's a higher ed involved complaint, and they do move it forward in a similar fashion. But they will only respond if the noise complaint is the priority on that complaint.
Okay. All right. But at least they're trained, they have the information, they know what the process is, and that at least is coordinated.
So they are...
I mean, our deputies are not responding to noise complaints. Our deputies are responding to gathering complaints. And with that gathering complaint may come a physical distancing violation or a face covering violation. So they're not being dispatched to... Our deputies are not being dispatched to anything other than the gathering.
Right, but those are likely kind of co-occurring events.
Martha, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just glad to hear that if they show up because it was a noise call, they would handle it relatively the same as we would. And they're not just walking away from the public health issues. Correct?
The IPD is responding to the calls that IPD is responding to, and it seems like they're filling out whatever the paperwork is that we have put out, and it's helping with the collection of data for us.
Okay.
Thank you. We will continue the conversation with leadership at the city and other municipalities as we try to continue to coordinate efforts. So, thank you. Anything else for Rich? Or anything else from you, Rich?
I would just say 273-8000. That is our special number that's set up if you have a complaint to make. So.
Thank you. Thanks, Rich. Health and Human Services Committee, Vice Chair is?
Me.
Who said me? Amanda?
Deborah.
Deborah, Vice Chair.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The HHS committee has not met since our last legislative meeting. We will be meeting on the 21st of this month at 1 p.m., and because that's a couple weeks away, I have no idea what will be the agenda, but I'm sure it will be interesting. Thank you.
It'll be profound, Deborah. Use the word of the year, profound. And definitely our good vibes go out to Shauna Black, who is the chair of this committee. We're thinking about you, Shauna. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Land, chair.
We've actually met twice since our last legislature meeting. We met on August 20th for regular, and we met just before this meeting for a special one for the airport resolutions that have already been acted on. We heard from Weights and Measures, one of our smallest departments that does some vital consumer protection work for us. He needed some new equipment. He doesn't have a very large budget, so that was why we authorized the contingent request for a new computer, which had been recommended by the IT department. We went through our normal capital payment summaries from our highway department and heard about some of the projects' progress that have been going along. We're keeping an eye on the Ludlowville Bridge project because that's quite important that be completed. And Jeff Smith told us that they're making very good progress there, and that should be completed before they need to totally close the Route 34B bridge, which the state will be rebuilding, and they need the detour for the Ludlowville Bridge, through the Ludlowville Bridge. I think it was kind of important, which was, we heard a yay from our chair. I think that was right. When we passed the resolution tonight to change the name of our airport to the Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport. We've invested a whole lot of money in that in the last couple of years. Rick Snyder talked about that as well. And it's an important thing to make our community a global community. We have a global university. We have global education here. And we need to have first-rate transportation. We know we have very, very poor highway access, for example. We have almost no passenger train access to Tompkins County. So the airport becomes more and more important as we go along. At today's facility meeting, Mike Hall reported that the good news that we will be resuming the Charlotte flight starting Wednesday. There will be one once a week. It will be down to Charlotte and back. The plane will stay here and then and move down. He said it probably says that there isn't a huge demand for airplanes overall if they're able to leave a plane on the ground that long. But that's good for us that there will be that flight. Those are some of the things we talked about. Our next meeting will be later this month. I forgot the date.
Thank you, Mike. Questions to Mike and Coleman?
Oh, I was going to read something. Annie, is that what you're going to tell me?
One or two more things, but go ahead.
Oh, you go ahead. Then I'll read this. It's very important.
Right. I was going to remind you of that. And mentioned about the non-pipeline alternative grant that they'll be getting?
I think Martha reported on that in terms of the floor.
Okay. There's been so many meetings before the legislative meeting. They're all starting to meld as one. And then the last thing, I thought the Charlotte was once a day, and they were able to possibly ramp it up to twice, but you thought it was only once a week? Anyway,
I hope you're right and I'm wrong. Let's put it that way.
Well, we can get clarification. That was all. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
I did want to take a second, if I could, Leslin, to read a letter that came to the legislature. Kind of an unusual letter. Not that it, we don't have wonderful employees, and our managers are very proud of them. I know that. We hear about it all the time. But once in a while, we get something like this. This is a letter to the legislature from our highway director, Jeffrey B. Smith, and I think it's worthy of reading. To the Honorable Legislature, I am compelled to acknowledge how proud I am of the employees of the Highway Department. As we all know, these have been trying times. COVID-19 has taken us all by surprise and forced us to adapt like never before imagined. I want to say thank you to County Legislature and County Administration for steadfast leadership regarding this pandemic. During the early years of the pandemic, before mask, I'm sorry, during the early days of the pandemic, before mask wearing, before little of anything was known about COVID-19, Highway Department employees were called to duty and acted without hesitation. Throughout spring, while most employees were home on emergency leave, this department was called into action on several occasions. This work included plowing during a few snow and ice events, as well as assessment and repair of road and bridge hazards. Working with the sheriffs and health department, highway staff helped coordinate and install the traffic control for the testing site at the mall. Not once was there a bit of hesitation from anyone while completing these essential tasks. Another tremendous attribute I want to mention regarding highway staff happened at the start of discussion regarding voluntary furlough. Employees worked together closely to determine who was best suited for the furlough and who would be helped by being allowed to continue to work. And while making sure the highway department was also staffed adequately, looking back, the wellness and concern shared by these employees was nothing less than spectacular. Even now, with return to what is close to normalcy, we are found with continued cooperation, awareness, and adaptability. This leaves me with a sense of optimism as we forge into this unknown future, believing that whatever comes next, this highway department will work together to overcome. I am truly proud to be a part of this highway department. And it's signed by Jeff B. Smith, our highway director. And so I thought this legislature would like to hear that nice note.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for reading that. Thank you, highway department. And Jeff for acknowledging his the employees in that way. All right. Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion Chair.
Yes, thank you, Leslin. I will be crisp. We are meeting this Thursday at 1:45. We are going to have some profound discussions about some policies from HR, the rules of the legislature again, and we have a couple of very profound resolutions that we will be taking up. So 1:45 on Thursday.
Love it. Profound and crisp. Anything for Amanda? Thank you very much. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I fear I will be neither crisp nor profound. We started kicking up our game. We've been lean and mean for most of the year. We had a couple of events worth mentioning outside of meetings, one of which is that Tompkins County representatives of various kinds put in a rousing and, I hope, effective appearance at the Public Service Commission hearing on the NYSEG and RG&E rate cases. I mean, I think RG&E's territory is probably every bit as large as NYSEG's, and we outnumbered the RG&E folks probably 3-1. And we covered every aspect of that rate case down to the tiniest element. So let's hope that that has some impact. Another thing I wanted to report on, Dave McKenna and I are privileged to serve on the board of the Soil and Water Conservation District. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with some of the financial problems that the Soil and Water Conservation Department had in prior years, but we got the audit report from Incero for that organization, and they got an unmodified report. I think that's the word.
Yeah.
And their fund balance has gone up substantially, and all of that, I think, is due to the excellent management of John Negley. So I wanted you all to know about that. We've had two meetings since our last Ledge meeting. The first one was a regular meeting. We got reports from DPS, Soil and Water, and CCE about how their work plans have been affected by COVID. The impacts were pretty much what you'd expect. To the extent that programs require person-to-person contact, they've been slowed down somewhat. On the other hand, even though priorities have been rearranged and some of the funding has been slowed down, the work has continued pretty much unabated, and we can all be proud of that. Barb Ekstrom reported to give us a heads up that, I don't know if y'all remember, way back pre-COVID, we passed a resolution that said that the county wouldn't be buying single-use plastics. Barb has been working with members of her staff on coming up with a policy proposal for an environmentally preferred product procurement policy, and that will be being rolled out in the next couple of months, so you'll be hearing more about that. I think at this stage it's going to relate mainly to plastic water bottles and single-use plastics. But in the future, I think it will extend to reflect the state's ban on styrofoam containers. We continue to have HABs. This year, surprisingly, there are more of them at the north end of the lake than in the south end of the lake. DPS is continuing to work on education and outreach and various other approaches to the HABs problems. And the CASE board subgroup that's been working on green workforce development gave a preliminary report. They've been working closely with Natalie Bernoski, and Anna has been involved in that. So this is another instance of PEAK and HED working together. We had an emergency meeting or a special meeting this afternoon before the Ledge, and I have two resolutions to offer in connection with that meeting. The first one is a resolution.
Hold on, Deborah. Any questions for Deborah on her report? No. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
So I would move the resolution in support of a green amendment to the New York State Constitution.
Second.
Okay. I'm going to let Anna address this and answer any questions that anyone may have, because this is her baby.
Thanks, Deborah. Yeah, this is pretty straightforward. It's the addition of 15 words to the New York State Constitution to create as a human right the access to clean air and clean water, essentially. That is what the addition would create. It did pass the 2019 legislature with very little opposition, but this is all constitutional changes need to go to a referendum, and it needs to be passed first by two consecutive legislatures. Since this year is an election year, then next year's legislative body will, in effect, be a second and unique legislature. So this is an effort that environmental advocates of New York is trying to push, and they have been connecting with counties throughout the state, hoping to get a collective support across the state. They reached out to us first because, as they said, we tend to be very environmentally conscious and we tend to take a lead on these things, and our support would help the effort to get the word out. So that is why we brought this forward, and I think that's everything.
Thank you, Anna. There's Deborah, I'm assuming you're moving the revised version that came out of committee?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Any questions or discussion on this resolution? Mike Lane.
I think it's a beautiful sentiment, interesting constitutional amendment. I just want to say that there are many unintended consequences here that none of us knows about. I'm going to support this, but this could be something that might cost the state and municipalities quite a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. And thank you, Mike. That was actually my question when I met with EANY. And they do have a four-page talking points document, having thought through some of those points. And that is in the peak agenda, I think, if you want to review that. And I can also email it to you. And I think that there's that recognition that it has that potential, and the cost benefit of ensuring clean air and water, particularly in the context of those laws being watered down or removed at the federal level over the last couple of years.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. And Coleman, you have a question?
Yes. So I attended the peak meeting, and I just, since you say you're proposing the one that was edited, I didn't know if you had said the revisions that were made to it, so everybody knows what we're voting on.
They were sent out by Kathy this afternoon to all of the legislators, but they are stylistic edits more than anything else.
Not anything substantive that changes?
No.
Right. Okay. So it wasn't anything that was changed during the meeting?
No.
Okay.
No.
I want to make sure everybody was clear on that.
Thank you. Roll call vote.
Ann Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
David McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Arthur Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich Dunn?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Leslie Lindeen Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
That carries unanimously. Thank you very much, Deborah. You have Resolution J.
Yes, this is the resolution that was added, urging the state to establish an active and formal role for counties in planning efforts related to the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, and to engage local governments throughout development of the Climate Action Council's scoping plan. I move that now.
I have a second. Please second by Martha Robertson.
And this is Martha's baby, as she represents us on NYSAC, so I will let her take it.
Okay.
Thank you, Deborah, and thanks very much to Peak for taking it up this afternoon. It's pretty self-explanatory that all these panels that the state has put together to put to develop the scoping plan for the Climate Act and to implement it, 127 individual members, and none of them represent county government, the closest, or town government either, or cities. The closest we come is that Ed Marks, the former commissioner here of planning, is appointed to the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel. That would be the logical one for a county representative to be there. It happens to have the smallest membership of all the other panels, so it would seem there's room for it. I understand from reports from the committee that both Bob Howarth and Peter Iwanowitz, who are both members on the Climate Action Council itself, when this list of appointments came up, they specifically asked, hey, what about local government? And they were told, well, we could consider additional members later. So, and then apparently Basil Sagos, the commissioner of DEC, actually said that it would be a slippery slope to have elected officials on any of these panels. So the next day, Steve Aquario from NYSAC ran off a letter, as I mentioned earlier, and I emailed that letter to you all. This is really, I mean, it's an insult. it really is, that local government is not represented on any of these nine groups. So I really appreciate your passing, the, you know, if we can pass this, and we will send it around to other counties and hope we might shake the trees a little bit.
Thank you, Martha. Thank you, Pete. Any other questions on this resolution? Folks. Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich Jenner?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Ian Klein?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Clairborn?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes. That carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Anything else from you, Deborah Papie? Thank you very much. Budget Capital and Personnel Committee meeting. Martha Robertson, chairperson.
Yeah, thank you very much. We last met on August 19th as a the budget committee to review the audit and pass the resolution that's in front of, going to be in front of you in a minute, and as the full expanded budget committee also on August 19th. And thank you all for taking the time to be there for that. Our next regular budget meeting is September 14th, Monday at 3 o'clock. I wanted to also mention publicly something I've emailed to you all today, that we are, we need to move the whole expanded budget committee set of meetings back. Jason has, as I asked earlier, what are the big numbers that we don't know yet? There are a number of really important pieces of information that are missing at this moment, and Jason has asked that we move the beginning of our budget season back from September 8th to September 14th. So we pulled heads together and came up with the revised schedule that I sent out this afternoon. If anybody didn't get it or has any questions about it, I'm happy to answer them. It still gets us to passing a tentative budget by October 20, or considering it, assuming passing a tentative budget on October 29th, a special legislature meeting, and that gets us to meet the charter, that the deadline for passing the tentative budget that's in the county charter. Kathy Covert pointed out we still need to figure out when the budget, the public hearing will be and when a final vote will be on the budget. So that will come next or soon. And as you remember, we, you know, of course, we have this nice big budget books that we carry around. The material that goes into those has to be sent to a printer, and they need about a week's lead time. So Jason expects we will not have all of that in time to get our full budget books on September 14th. I assume, as of this afternoon, he thought we, you can correct me if this has changed, Jason, but he expected we could get the material in hard copy for the September 14th departments. That would be Jason's presentation, the capital budget, and if there's time, any other departments that would present on the 14th. The rest of the budget book, we expect we could get by the end of that week. So we will get them in two batches. And if that's still true, Jason, please let us know. Thumbs up. That's still the plan. So I believe that that is all the news there. You know, this, it's going to be a little bit, there's going to be a lot of discipline needed by all of us to really, we've shrunk the whole, the total time again a little bit from typical in this new schedule. But I trust that everybody can pitch in and we'll make that work. So if there are no questions about that, I can go to, I just got the audit resolution.
I don't see any questions. Go ahead.
Okay, great. And I know Jason and Kevin and everybody else has been working like crazy on this.
department heads have been really knuckling down, and I know Jason and Kevin are kind of sleeping socially distantly in the old jail to work on the budget. We really appreciate all the effort that's going into that. It's just a crazy project. So the resolution is ID 9494, Resolution H, acceptance of the audited financial report for the fiscal year ended December 31st, 2019, and I so move.
May I have a second, please? Second by Deb Dawson.
And I want to add thanks to what Rick said earlier about the team that's worked on this with Drew and Diane, and especially comment that this year they had to go through the audit remotely. You all remember those weeks when the auditors used to take up the small side of the old jail and they'd come and kind of camp out and live here. They couldn't do that this year. To invent, together with ITS, had to invent a whole new way of doing the audit, and took a little longer, but they got it done. And we're really appreciative of everybody at INSERO who worked very well with our team. You know, good results and a clean audit. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Let's go to a vote.
Ann Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mori?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Ziegler?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Leslyn Whitby Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That's my report.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. There's a question from Dan.
Yeah, a question I did, going back half a step about the scheduling. So if I understood correctly, we scheduled an extended budget committee voting session when we had previously had the public hearing scheduled. Is that right?
No.
I had a public hearing on budget on the 27th. Okay.
You talked about a public forum.
Okay. Here's my question. Do we need to have a public hearing before the tentative vote?
No. What we do is we have a public forum relatively early. It's scheduled for October 7th.
Right.
I'm going to ask Kathy if that's right. I think that's what I have.
That's right. No.
All right.
Okay. And the public.
You can clarify and make sure everybody gets that information.
Thank you.
And the public hearing is after we have the budget before we vote on the final budget.
All right. Reports for the Inclusion Committee.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will attempt to be crisp yet profound. So our last meeting was on the 26th of August, and we had a profound discussion from the JEDI team, the Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion team. And we had an update on the Chief Equity and Diversity Officer position. So Deanna Carruthers, I believe, will be starting next week, but somebody could correct me if that's incorrect. So we're very excited about that. And look forward to having her a member of WDIC. We discussed Hispanic Latin. We discussed Hispanic Latinx Heritage Month, which starts September 15th, and I believe Henry Grandison will be bringing us a proclamation for that at our next meeting, which also happens to be on the 15th of September. And then we had an update on the police reform task force. Our next meeting is set for Wednesday, September 23rd at 3:30, which is a couple of weeks away. But so far we have on our proposed agenda is to work on our diversity policy. And that's it.
Thank you, Annie. Any questions for Annie? All right, moving on. Tiger Committee, Martha Robertson Chair.
Found for last, I know. We have not met since the last legislature meeting. We meet tomorrow at 11:30, and we are going to have Amanda Spellacy from Chuck Schumer's office on the agenda again, and Allison Hunt from Tom Reed's office. We're also having Barbara Lifton, Assemblywoman Barbara Lifton, to join us to sort of open the floor to all things Albany that she wants to talk about. And so a late-breaking addition. Mike Kaplinka-Lair, representing the census, regional director, Mike Lane, is that his position? I guess he's supervising 10 counties with the census. He's coming to talk with us. We had earlier talked about having a resolution asking that September 30th deadline be pushed back to October 31st. So we've exchanged some information. We're going to hear from him tomorrow, put together a resolution, and I will ask the committee to have a short special meeting before the next legislature meeting so we can get that resolution on the agenda. So that would be coming up next.
Thank you. Questions to Martha and Tiger? No? All right. Thank you very much. There are no member filed resolutions, minutes of the previous meeting. Moved by Deb Dawson, seconded by Anna Kellis. Are there any corrections to the minutes that we need to hear about? No? All right. All in favor of the minutes, let's vote.
Dan Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Jason Kenner?
Yes.
Lynn Mori? Yes. Mike Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Tucker Dawson?
Yes.
Andy Granderson?
Yes.
Chris Jones?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Leslie McKinney-Trevorn?
Yes. Thank you. Is there any unfinished business? Motion to adjourn. Vote by Anna Kellis, seconded by Mike Sigler. Thank you very much. All in favor of adjourning. Everybody is happy. They're all waving and adjourning. Goodbye. Good night.